recently of coaching. Campaigns have been completely, the system is completely overhauled today. It's not working. And there are a lot more people on the roads than otherwise would be, but I think, look, this is the first informal briefing. This is not the end of the world. So, if it's okay, Momo, you guided by you partly, look at the special voluntary disclosure bill specifically first, because that's a major preoccupation. We thought we would be able to get it done quickly, but it occurs to me, could you explain quickly the process, because I realize you've advertised it for comments. Just tell us a bit about what date, excuse me, what date, by what date people from the public can comment on your book.
The change, as you will see, it's just incorporated into the late bill, which, like all these bills, are split into two, the money bill bit and the admin bill.
Yeah, but see, I read the bill and you'll need it.
See, we got this called brief administration bill, right? Well, this is...
There's two.
I don't know, I understand it was a bunch of... when I was at the office yesterday, I didn't see you had another book, right? I read the monetary book.
Yeah.
I don't know, just this one.
Yeah.
So what I wanted to ask you is... But these are two separate bills.
Remember with the tax bill, what you have to do is... That's why we call them a central bill.
Yeah.
You know, one doesn't go without the other. But we have to... Our constitution
is split
into the money bill, and those aspects that are not part of the money bill.
I understand all of that. You explained that for the 2 years in a row. There's no harm in explaining it. Yes, against the bit of news. Mr. Qualifies, he very, very can come. What I'm asking, though, is in our purpose of this moment to facilitate user friendliness. I don't have a view. I'm just saying, would it not be useful to look at them as they are given to us as two sets of bills, though they are the reason?
Generally not, because what you find is as part of the building the one.
Oh,
the one and the other.
Alright.
So.
Alright, fine.
Yeah.
Okay, are we agreeing that we do it the way it's supposed to be, just because it doesn't make sense to me, on reflection? Is that fine? Good. Nobody said anything I teach you that day for fine. Go ahead.
Okay, Chair. So thank you very much, Chair. And I think, okay, this is the content you can speak to. So, Chair, basically, I think just to get the process right and for the new members, as you know, the tax proposal...
Can I just do this because Ellen's not here. Shivambu's not here and Komo's not here. Kekani is not here. So I think the other two members will come. Thank you.
So just to get members to understand the process, because otherwise you tend to forget these things quite easily, that you've got the tax proposals that are published on Budget Day. Obviously, the Minister refers to some of them in his speech, but the detail is out in the Budget Review, which goes into, of course, it is in much more detail. I mean, the speech just makes the announcements, but you have to read the detail both in Chapter 4 and then in Annexure C of the Budget Review, which has a lot of the technical proposals, corrections or tax avoidance, etc. So it's quite important, I think, that members actually go back to the Budget Review and sort of look at the proposals. Now, what we then do is we, the one element of the budget process that we've discussed here a few times is that it probably would be a good idea within the 10-day period to come and talk about the tax proposals as a dedicated thing, because then you know exactly what all the proposals say. So what we're doing today is, although we're going to deal with specific bills, we'll also just give you an overview of the main tax proposals in the budget. Then the specific legislation that follows, this year had the Revenue Laws Amendment Bill. Now that was an exceptional bill. Normally it doesn't come, if we do have it, it doesn't also come first. But that was to deal with the annuity problem, but it's an exception. But normally what we have and what we publish on Budget Day now, 2 years in a row, is to have the rate and monetary amounts and amendment of revenue laws bills. And again, this is a set of two bills that we publish for the money bill and admin bill. And they deal with changes in tax rates and monetary thresholds and small admin issues. necessarily. Like this, it will deal with the special VDP voluntary disclosure program. Then later in the year, around July, we publish a lot of the more complex tax announcements, those that just don't mean changing the personal income tax rate, for example. It's just you start to talk about the base changes, you might have real substantive proposals, and that only gets published in July. And this is because tax being tax, we don't tell anybody beforehand, before we announce what we're going to announce. So after it's announced, we actually have lots of meetings with particular sectors that may be involved to draw up the legislation. And that culminates on the tax laws amendment bill, which we publish, and then we get detailed public comments there. At the same time, Parliament also has its hearings, and then once all of those processes are completed, because of this tax bill issue, they will get formally tabled. So even the rates bill have not been tabled, we just publish it, unlike other bills, okay, that members would be used to, which are off the table first. I think we've experienced what it means then to amend the money bill, so that's why we have the discussion first and amend. Other tax laws that you'd expect later this year is the carbon tax bill, that will be coming as well. So these are the tax bills for now. Normally we have the revenue laws amendment bill, which is still need another bill after the TNAP, which the last few years we tried not to do. So today, just to explain what the chair asked right at the start, is that we're forced to split the bills, almost all tax bills, we're forced to split them into the money bill and the admin bill. This is because, and those are clauses related to the constitution, you read the provisions on the money bill. So obviously these are the two bills. The one has the in the bracket administration, but they have the very similar name. As I said, both bills were published on budget day. There were some slight legislative simplifications, which we published last week and asked for further public comments. And as I said, what this bill deals with. Move on. So, Cecil, you want to get on to, because we're dealing with the level of the tax and the scope, obviously, you know, to make the obvious point, the primary objective of tax policy is to raise revenue. You need expenditure on education, health, you can have a long list, you can see it there. But I should add that in today's world, we also, although that's a primary motive, we also have secondary motives like changing behavior, hence you get the shoe tax. There's no sort of, people often ask how do we compare to other countries, and I think we'll give you those comparisons, and it's important to factor in, especially because people outside, investors and so on, look at different levels of tax and then assess whether to. It's a big consideration whether they come into this country or that country. But it should be understood the overall level really is a result of many decisions on government expenditure, and not just at the national level, but at a local level, at provincial level, because in our system you decide on the amount of transfers. If you go, for example, many countries, when you look at a budget, you just look at the federal budget or the national budget. You really don't get a sense for what the overall level is, because you know, especially in a federal system, the states have significant powers of taxation. Others, but you know, more or less, the provinces have hardly have any taxation powers beyond motor car license fees and gambling, but motor car license fees is the biggest one. And as local government, it's mainly your property rates that applies. And then, of course, they make some money from utilities. But those are user charges. So, you know, it depends on the system you have. It depends on the political choices you make as a country, what to fund, what not to fund. Jump already. I've finished that. Okay. Obviously, we may have other considerations, like one's economic growth. So the tax mix between direct and indirect charges or taxes is also important. In all of this, the incidence of a tax is important. So, for example, people often say, increase or decrease the corporate income tax. The problem with the corporate income tax, aside from competitiveness and so on, is that the incidence will fall on customers. So any effect of a tax is important. And of course, we do need to look at the efficiency, because there's often taxes, we used to have the RSC levies, which are extremely inefficient. There's equity considerations, there's transparency, simplicity, all of those are sort of factors that need to take into account. I don't know if you want to add, but I don't know if you take over.
Thanks a lot. Thanks, Chair.
I didn't give name for the new member, so it's myself, Ismail Mamonia, Head of Tax and Financial Sector Policy, Cecil Morden, Yana Puta from the Trade in France, from SARS, and then we've got our colleagues, Johan Ure from the SARS. Are you alone? No, okay, Kevin Stowe. They're from the SARS, because on the VDP, although there's no change in legislation for them, because it's done through export legislation, they will also comment on the VDP as they are affected.
Chair, this is just an overview slide to indicate to you the type of tax instrument that we do have in the country. There are three main taxes, which is highlighted in red, and the others are smaller taxes that have different purposes, some of them other than just raising revenue. Just in terms of the issue that Norma has spoken about, there's a long-standing debate about the appropriate balance between direct taxes and indirect taxes. There's no sort of one right answer. But just to give you a history of the differences in the composition between direct taxes and indirect taxes. And on average, one could argue that in South Africa, we have a reasonable balance of around about 35% direct taxes and 45% indirect taxes, if you take a long-term average. This gives you an indication of the taxes by the revenue by instrument, and you see that the, from a revenue perspective, the most important tax instrument are taxes on individuals, accounting for 36% of revenue last year, followed by VAT at 26%, and company tax, and then you've got the four other smaller taxes that are significant. Very importantly, those three taxes together, PIT, VAT, and CIT, accounts for around about 80% of total tax revenue. This is a graph that shows you the percentage contribution of these three taxes over time, and you can see there was a very important stable contribution by VAT, which is the graph a little bit hidden there, and then the sort of inverse relationship in some years between CIT and PIT. In the years where we could gather quite a lot of CIT revenue from 1999 onwards, we managed to give quite a bit of relief on the personal income tax side. In the latter years, that story had flipped and changed around. Corporate tax is under pressure due to various reasons, low commodity prices, and therefore CIT had to come up and fill the gap. The next slide is just expressing the same information in terms of percentage of GDP, because if you do country comparison, looking at GDP data is quite useful, and this graph just shows you the GDP tax GDP ratio at the national level, where we have been on the journey. We traveled quite a high ratio we achieved in 2007-08, just before the financial crisis, and a significant drop after that, and a slow recovery since then. This is the same information, just on a nominal basis, shows you significant drop for the first time in very prolonged period that we had actually a drop in revenue, nominal revenue, just sort of at the end of the crisis. It recovered quite a bit, and then it sort of slowed down. You can see since 2011-12, nominal growth in revenue has slowed down quite a bit.
So just to emphasize, I mean, every year, just with inflation or the increases, you're going to collect more than you did last year if you continue to collect at the same pace. And that's what we generally do. Except in 2009, we actually collected less than the previous year, and that was with the global financial crisis and the subsequent recession that you had.
And just to surround this revenue story, for this year, you'll see that we have budgeted in the 2015 budget for the first sort of hard number for 2015 was 1.081 trillion. Band. In the MQS, we revised it down because of the slowdown in the economy. And in the budget of this year, we revised it down again. There were two revisions downwards as a result of the slowdown in the economy. The actual outcome was pretty close to the budget figures in 2016, about 157 million more, so it's very, very close. But you can see if you compare it with the budget of 2015, 11.4 billion below the target, largely chair as a result of the slowdown.
So, this is quite important. So obviously, since the budget, we've now got new information, which is what we collected for the entire financial year. But, and that amount is close to what was already the revised figure published in this year's budget. But remember, the initial comparator is against what if we project revenue for the financial year that's just finished, 2015-16. It was done in last year's budget, and we projected 1.08 trillion. But the outcome then was closer to 1.069. And we revised that down, firstly in the MTPPS, revised it down again in the budget. And that sort of more or less matched where SARS came in on the revenue.
So there's no doubt about the fact that our economy has been slowing down and that has an impact on revenue, and that raises a challenge as well in terms of the fiscal framework, and I think we've had quite a lot of debate about the broad fiscal framework in another meeting. I'm not going to go into the end slide. This slide just gives you some comparative figures on the tax GDP ratio in other countries. You have selected countries, you can choose and pick which countries you do. There's a mix of developed and emerging economies here. And then come back to the question.
As the usual caveat, you said it's hard to go compare across countries. You need to take where they tax at what level. You need to take into account whether they have a social security system, as you have in countries like Sweden and Germany. So therefore, their tax to GDP is much higher than in other countries.
Now, Chair, on the specifics on the rates bill, we in the budget have basically three main sources of revenue this year. One is we gave only partial fiscal direct relief, and that, if you do the sums, brought in about 7.6 billion. Then we increased excise taxes on fuel, and we also increased the capital gain tax. And that together, at the gross level, we estimate will be about 10 billion rand. We have annually a big debate about fiscal direct, and this year we only gave partial fiscal direct relief, but it's granted. So the next few slides just show you where that fiscal drag was given and where, how did we manage to get it.
So,
I think it contains a lot, Cecil, so just go through it slowly, because, and just start with fiscal drag and just explain.
Yeah, I remember that for many of us, not really, this tax is extremely challenging. 3 years now, and I still find it very challenging. And I don't have any business experience. I don't want to fail other businesses. That's why we started at 9:30. Not that we're going to sit here for one hour if you don't think about this issue. We need to. I can't stop them from gathering on. But I really don't think we need to know about inflation. But let's go properly do
that. Let me go to this slide and I'll go back to the previous slide. So if you look at this slide, on the left-hand side is the 15-16 personal income tax panel. And so the first bracket starts from zero, goes to 181,900. That's the level at which we tax people at 18%. The next bracket starts at 181 and it goes to 284. So that was the bracket that we got. Now it's important that every year we try to adjust this for inflation, because if we don't adjust it for inflation, what will happen is if you get an inflationary increase, these brackets are not adjusted, so tax liability increase without a real income increase. And that is what we call about fiscal debt.
We move into a higher tax. So we move into a higher tax.
So if you, for example, were earning 181,000 this year, you get a 5% increase just for inflation, you move to the next bracket, but your real income hasn't really increased. And therefore, it's important that you adjust these brackets on an annual basis. But adjusting these brackets on an annual basis obviously has financial implications for the fiscal. And so this year, it was difficult to adjust it for inflation. And so you'll see that the 181,900 has been adjusted to 188,000. And the 284 has been adjusted to 293, and the 393 has been adjusted to 405. And that's where we stopped. And that's where we stopped. the top bracket we didn't adjust at all. We also have rebates, so in calculating your tax liability, we tax you at that particular rate that is in the table, but we give you a credit, which is a, what we call rebate, primary rebate, secondary rebate, and adjusted rebate. Those are age dependent. The primary rebate applies to everybody, and that we increase from 13,207 to 13,500. The others we didn't change at all. Going to the previous slide, then shows you that we only adjusted those earlier brackets for the bottom by 3.4 and the primary rebate by 1.8%. Very clearly indications that we didn't give full fiscal drag, and that is where some of the revenue comes from. There's an important monetary credit.
You're going to go back to the previous one.
Yeah, I did quickly. Let me explain.
Okay.
There's an important monetary credit that we have in the system. It's a medical tax credit. It used to be a deduction, and for the past 5 years now it's credit. And we adjust that annually as lead by inflation. And so you see there the amount has been adjusted from 270 per month for the first two beneficiaries to 286. And for any additional beneficiary from 181 to 192. Our estimate is that this additional increase is about 1.1 billion rand relief that we provide. This slide just shows you again very more granular detail where the taxpayers are sitting in terms of the income brackets. Bearing in mind that the first column shows you taxable income, and that is after deduction, so this is not gross income, but it's taxable income. Then we have an estimate of the number of registered individuals by category. As you see, most of the people in South Africa, we've got about 13.7 million people on this table. And that's all the people that we get information from. I think South has got slightly more on their register, but a lot of those people is probably far below the threshold. So for this, and this is about the number of workers in the country. About 14 million people that are actually one other way formally employed. Roughly 6.6 million of them falls below the income expression. So quite a lot of people earning a taxable income below the middle. And then you can see there's a significant number of people in the category 70,000 to 150,000 and 150,000 to 250,000. So a large proportion of South Africans falls sort of in the bottom spectrum of the income distribution, shows you significant skewness in the income distribution that you have. That filters through in the tax liabilities, the tax people pay. What we try to highlight here is that the tax relief we've given here was sort of focused at the bottom, and how also the medical tax credit is also a relatively redistribution.
You know, the interesting thing is that most of this is the taxable income. So if you look at it, you'll see that most of your income actually comes from the second band, 338 billion, 317 billion, for the 250 to 340. Because even though people may not be rich there, but there's many, many, many people. So you get a lot of revenue from the middle to low. Once you start getting to 750,000 in taxable income, you notice then that you only get 169 billion. Okay, because you now get very few people. It jumps up a bit, but you've got a huge spend on the 1.5 million and above. But you broke that up as well into smaller lots, you'll find.
And some of the data is sort of more detailed in the annual tax statistics that we publish with SARS, so we can go back. This just shows you, Chad, the importance of the personal income tax system in our country and the progressive nature of it. So this is an estimate of a person that earns $5,000 per year. That person will pay approximately 2% personal income tax. And you can see as your income increases, your effective tax rate also increases, where at the top end, a person earning R1 million a year pays around about 32% of his income. These are average tax rates, so obviously different from the marginal tax rates that you have. Moving on to the next topic, Chair, is the issue of capital gains. Capital gains is an important fact that we introduced in 2001, and it was important for two reasons. One, you protect the income tax base because people were moving their income from what is called sort of ordinary revenue to capital gains, which at this stage is not capital. And there was a lot of game plans that SARS can tell us a lot more about that. What we then have done over the past 2 years, over the past sort of 14-15, we've increased the inclusion rate or the effective tax rate on capital gains gradually, and this year you will see there the figures. So we include now, if you make a capital gains for as an individual, 40% of that gain is added to your income and tax. If you work out the effective tax rate at the top end, that is now around about 16.4%. For companies, the inclusion rate has increased to 80%, and if you say 80% as a percentage of the current corporate tax rate, which is 28%, you get 32%, and for trusts slightly higher. So again, this is intended to make the system slightly more progressive. There is a concern about the effect this has on entrepreneurship and capital formation, but we think that they are still pretty easy. And as I said, this change we estimate will bring about an additional 2 billion taxes. We also made a small change to the transfer duties. The transfer duties is tax paid when you buy a property, so it's the actual buyer that pays the transfer duty. You don't pay that. And then we've got a gradual rate. So for the first, for any property below 750,000, there's no transfer duty payable. And then it goes up gradually from 3% up to 11%. Now this year we add an extra bracket right at the top.
Can you, if you buy a property below 1,000,000,
750,000. So that you see the very first bracket there, 0 to 750,000, the property, the transfer duty in there is 0. So you don't pay any property.
You don't pay
your origin. No, but remember, this is transfer duty. This is not your lawyer's cost. Because when you buy a property, there's lots of lawyer's expenses and fees. This is just the tax that you impose. So you will pay. When you buy a property of any value, there will be cost involved, but there will be most transaction costs by the voice, the deeds office. So we added the bracket here, as you see on the right-hand side, for properties above 10 million, we've increased the maximum rate from 11% to 13%. Any implications, not a lot, about 10 million, but it's a gain. Then the other increases of monetary amounts is on excise taxes, duties and fuel. This just gives you an overview of what we've done. Excise duties on alcohol and tobacco. The general fuel levy, increases in environmental levies, and then the proposed increase or introduction of the sugar tax. This is a pretty detailed in terms of the type of alcoholic beverages. This is a summary slide. There's a lot more detail in the bill. The bill goes into a lot more detail. Previous slide. We'll come to that now.
Some of this is covered in the bill.
Others is by regulation, sir.
Others is by customs legislation that gets rejected. And some of these lines on alcohol age effects is an
Can I just say, that's the installation, and then you can ask questions, but this is a couple of parents who should do it here. Allow it, but gratitude is a chair, there's no other, there's no different rule that I see. So unless it actually, I don't know why a certain person is smiling there, but I'm going to make the questions of concrete to the because you're slow in eating. Can we just go to those things? If you didn't hear you for the first time, allow it. Second time you didn't hear it, it's your problem to listen. I'm not going to allow it. Go ahead.
So as I said, there's a detailed table in the bill that goes into a lot more detail on the different categories of alcohol and tobacco. This is just a high level summary to show you what is the rate. Some of it's grams per liter, others is grams per kilogram or per gram. And you see that the increase, for example, for both years, the nominal increase was 8.5%, slightly above inflation. For 45 wine, also 8%, and then for spirits, was 8.2%. For cigarettes, it was around about 7%, just below 7% for all the tobacco products. So this is a pretty detailed and as long as it helps, it's part of the bill, but it came in fact immediately after it was tabled. So this is not part of the bill. So the fuel levy is by regulation. It's been increased this year. We didn't increase the road accident fund levy. We only increased the general fuel levy, as we call it. In the bill, it's just a fuel levy. And it's been increased from 285 cents per liter to, from 255 cents per liter for petrol to 285, and for diesel from 240 to 270, which is a 30 cent increase. And this was done by regulation. And Frank, please help me. Do we at one stage come back and confirm this? So, although this is done by regulation, it all gets ratified by Parliament once a year. Frank can talk about it. This just shows you the challenge we have with the fuel levy. It's been not a very elastic revenue source. It's sort of, as a percentage of revenue, declined quite a lot because we didn't increase the fuel levy for above inflation. And then there was a slight increase from around about 2008 to this year. This is the same slide expressed as a percentage of GDP. And then there's a few smaller environmental type levies here that is similar to the fuel levy done by regulation as part of the customs and excise regulation. So the plastic bag levy has been in place now for a couple of years and has been increased now from 6 cents per bag to 8 cents per bag. And that came into effect on the 1st of April. Also by regulation. Similar is there was one at one stage and there's still debate about whether we should completely ban pedestrian light stop. But for the moment there is a levy and that levy is also increased from 4 amperes to 6 amperes. Then there is a levy on motor vehicles, new motor vehicles, based on their emissions. This increase also came into effect in 1 April by the regulation. And we have a tax rate of 90 rand increased to 100 rand for every gram of emissions above per kilometer. And for double cabs, it's a slightly higher rate. Then she has the tire levy. The tire levy is a levy that we have announced in the budget. Actually, we announced it last year already, 2015. But because of extensive consultation, the levy wasn't implemented last year. We announced it again this year, and the proposal is that the levy will come into effect on the 1st of October this year. It will be by way of regulations like the other environmental type of levies. There's an extensive list of the type of tires in the bill, and the debate here was about the current fee that has been paid, and you actually currently do pay a fee on tires, which is administered by the which is governed by rules issued by the Department of Environmental Affairs and collected by an agency called NEPA. As from the 1st of October, the plan is that SARS will take over that collection and we will do it form of tax.
This one is going to be called the VW tax box, which is subscribed. Yes.
Chair, this is just a summary slide which is an extract of the budget review that shows you the net revenue from the various adjustments we've made. The earlier slide showed you the gross revenue adjustments, so I wouldn't spend too much time on this slide, but this is for the reference. That really deals with all the changes in terms of monetary amounts this year and rates or cents per liter. The next part of the slide deals with the special voluntary disclosure relief initiative. And I'll hand over to my two colleagues,
Thanks, Cecil. Thanks, Chair. So, special voluntary disclosure program. members will be aware, because we brought the concept of an international tax standard to you, that there is a very important development in the international tax space, which is the exchange of information on investments and income on an automatic basis. Right, so that framework has been put in our Tax Administration Act, and there are 98 odd countries that have committed to this so far, and South Africa is in the group of 55, which are known as the early adopters. That means we have started collecting information already. Our banks are starting to collect the information. They will report it to SARS next year, and then we will start exchanging it with other governments so that we'll find out what's happening in their jurisdictions, and they will find out what's happening here. So if you have someone from the UK who's an account in South Africa, we'll let them know. Someone from South Africa with an account in the UK, we'll know. So that is a game changer as far as the world is concerned. And the reason it's important is simply the spread of
things. Thank you, that's wonderful, but it is important to note that there are some countries who have reservations to say that they will not adopt the automatic exchange of information like Panama.
Yes, I'll get you there. So, I mean, we'll get to that aspect in a moment. So, I'm just looking at the list of 98. I'll just pick up a few. So, in right alphabetical order, the first or early adopters start with Angola, Argentina, Barbados, Belgium, Bermuda, British Virgin Islands, Bulgaria, the Cayman Islands, Colombia, Croatia. Goes all the way down to Sweden, Trinidad and Tobago, Turks and Caicos Islands, and the United Kingdom. And starting in 2018, we get another group of 43 countries coming online. That's Albania, Andorra, Antigua and Barbuda, Aruba, Australia, Austria, going down then to St. Martin, Switzerland, Turkey, the United Arab Emirates, Uruguay, and Vanuatu. So as Younger has said, there are a couple of countries that are holdouts at this point, and the two that are listed in the little schedule I have in front of me are Bahrain and Panama. But as people who thought Panama was a black box have discovered, sometimes leaks happen. And, well, I can't say how they happen. I know the speculation is that there was some software on their website that wasn't particularly secure and that sort of allowed someone entry. But that gives rise to what are known as the Panama Papers. And that's one in the long line of these kinds of leaks that have happened. I mean, we've had the so-called Lux leaks, the offshore leaks, the Swiss leaks, the HSBC. Now we have Panama. And each time that happens, it sort of undermines this concept that it's a great idea to try and hide what you're doing. So we have a dramatically changing international landscape. And needless to say, as people on the outside noticed this, they came and reported to Treasury and to SARS and to the Fed's Tax Committee and basically to anyone who would hear them that it would really, really be a good idea if they could come clean and regularize their affairs. So that's what we have. We have the proposal for a special voluntary disclosure program. Now, good design practice for these things is to open them for a relatively limited period, allow people to come forward, and then when it closes, you go after the people who haven't come forward with the full force of law. And because of developments in the international space, that is becoming a more and more real threat. So, what does that mean? It means that the proposal is we open on the 1st of October, and we're going to see it until the 1st of March next year. Why the 1st of October? Well, it gives people an opportunity to start preparing right now. And second of all, well, we were being realistic about the kind of time frame it would take to get the legislation in place, so that the two would be at least close to each other. Because we already have a voluntary disclosure program in our Tax Administration Act, it's SARS, so we already have a framework for this all to happen. So essentially we reuse that framework, and the idea is we just tweak it a little bit. So one of the points that we make is, well, clearly it's not so voluntary, we already have the information exchanged with us, so we know about the information, so that is excluded. And next slide. We get down to what's the additional relief in terms of this. So the idea here is that for what happened before the 1st of March 2015, we say, okay, we include half of that into your taxable income. Why half? So we don't get into debates about whether it's a taxable, a capital gain, not taxable. It's quick, clean, and we have a simple answer to the question.
That's slide 34.
Right. Okay. Then, oops, there's a problem with the printing. Apologies, guys. So that's the one aspect. The other is investment returns. It sometimes be difficult to go back a very long time with. So we're saying, okay, we stop taxing those from the 1st of March 2010. We tax that in full. And we stop the interest clock running from essentially 2010, which is when we started taxing you. If you make an application, you know, under statement penalties, if you're successful. And then the idea is, because we're reusing the basic framework, is we'll use the existing processes at SARS, but quite an important change here is that we will be redesigning the process so that you can essentially apply both for the tax side of the special EDP and the exchange control side on the same form, and that we can then process it in an integrated fashion with our Reserve Bank colleagues. Which then takes us to exchange control relief, and I'll hand over for that.
Thank you, Frans. As Frans has mentioned, the exchange control special voluntary disclosure program, our intention is to have a joint application form, as Frans has mentioned. Our calculations will differ totally from how they will calculate the levies payable. For us, we look at your unauthorized assets as of 29 February 2016. You give us the current market value thereof, as well as documentary proof. It's a bank account. You give us a bank statement. We will then calculate if you want to retain the unauthorized funds offshore. We will then calculate the penalty of 10% on the amount. If you're willing to bring it back to South Africa, we'll only ask a 5% levy. And your levy must be paid out of offshore funds to qualify for a 5 or 10% levy. If you don't have liquid assets offshore to pay the levy, then we'll add another 2% to say to pay it out of your South African assets. So that will mean you'll pay 12%. We do have a current legislation in place under the Exchange Control Regulations 1961. We have Regulation 24, which was promulgated, if I remember correctly, it was November 2010. So our legislation is in place, and it will be for the same window period as the tax SVDP. And as I said, it will be a joint operation going forward. People who are currently under investigation, or if you are aware of irregularities under your name, won't be allowed to apply for the SVDP process. And that's basically it from our side. Thank you.
That is really the issues that are in the bill, and some of the stuff that are by regulations. There's a few slides that we thought we would include just to notify you about some of the high-level proposals that will be in the TLAB. I'm not sure you want to discuss this now, or you first want to make a discussion on the other issues. So these are not in the bill. This will come to the committee later on. A very important initiative that we have undertaken over the past few years was to help upskill our youth, and also to provide an incentive for youth employment. So we've got two incentives in the tax system. One is the leadership allowance, and the other one the employment tax incentive. Both these incentives had a time limit. The one was introduced way back in 2002, and we've renewed it a few times. The other one was introduced in 2014, with a lot of controversy around it. We are in process of evaluating, especially the employment tax incentives, but at the same time the leadership incentive. And we hope to come with a report to the committee later this year. There's a requirement in legislation to report to the committee. But also have to review it and decide whether we keep it alive or we abandon it or change it.
that's an important exercise, a very complex exercise that we're trying to do now, and we'll come to the committee later this year to talk about progress. There's also an incentive that we encourage employers to provide bursaries to their the children or their employers and needs, and there are monetary amounts attached to those who will qualify in the amount of the bursaries. And we are proposing adjustments to the network in the ceiling. And then, there is a public benefit activity that is associated with training. Some of them are not captured currently in that environment or in a framework. We intend to expand that. So we think, in terms of this amendment here, we can make some positive contribution to students. Then the issue of trust, Jen, is a complex issue that has been on cards for many years now. We are taking a very small step this year just to look at the linkages between trust and the state duty. And obviously, there would be further work going down this path. So that will also be in the delay. And then the carbon tax bill we published for public comment, initial draft, in November. We had an extensive consultation last week with various players. We will be revising the draft bill and then table that bill for your consideration. And this is a statement that we've made in the budget review with respect to the process.
No, Chair, I think I think, look, the issue of obesity is a major challenge, not as important, not as big as climate change, but certainly a major one in terms of mortality and so on. I think if one reads all around it today, a lot of media coverage and the impact on health. The Department of Health has published a policy paper last year, and there have been sort of, as I said, when you look at tax policy, increasingly there's an attempt to use it as part of a package of measures to deal with specific problems. The most famous one, of course, is with tobacco and alcohol. And it will also say, you know, a tax on a particular product is not going to by itself change behavior. It may change it in the margin. But you need your complementary initiatives like education, making sure in this instance that sugary products are not sold in school shops, and so on. Educating parents about what they should feed their kids. And certainly you see increasingly many countries, Denmark, Finland, France, Hungary, Ireland, Mexico, Norway. And after our announcement, in fact the UK has also announced that they will be implementing a tax on sugary drinks. What we mean by sugary drinks, I think we've been asked how wide we go. I think this is the first step. We do intend to have it in place by 1st of April next year. I know our minister was hoping we had it in place on the 1st of April this year, but we didn't think legislation could have passed so quickly. It's also just meant then to get us talking to help to others to have a more coordinated approach. So what the base will be, what gets included, what doesn't get included, and certainly down the line, I see the text being used even more. So I think this will be a first step, and what we tend to do is just to publish a concept note, which will provide a few more details. We're still in the process of consulting, getting lots of people wanting to visit us, certainly from the industry side, wanting to know what the impact is going to be. So thank you, Chair. This is a big intervention.
Thanks, Mom. Yes, as I said, Mom said, we will publish a concept note for comment towards the end of June, and it will take us about 4 or 5 months, Chair, to finalize the design of this. And by budget time next year, we should know exactly how it's going to be. And that really is our decision.
Thank you. Just for your information, for members,
all right, a few members, please.
Time to hand up.
Models, where especially in in the context of a slowing economic growth, what is the elasticity or the responsiveness of economic growth to these changes in tax? Generally speaking, and I'm sure about the big ones you know, especially the personal, the income tax, and the corporate tax. Special voluntary disclosure program. Can I start by asking the question? Is it an illegal activity? That's number one. Is it necessarily an illegal activity? Has it not been broken? If law has been broken, what is the motivation that behind this amnesty? If law has been broken, I'm looking at Ashim here. What is the motivation in this amnesty? Because for me, that sort of encourages this behavior. If time and again, you know that if we are found, if we broken the law, we're going to be prosecuted. But the example that it's a disclosure program, as you said, this is not the first one. For me, I'm seeing the challenge consistent through the moral hazard situation that we're deliberately creating here. But I would like to hear from Sata Nikia. Thanks, Chair. Those would be my questions.
Number three, I think it's Mr. Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That number three reminds me of a radio program about number one and number two from the ministry or something. That's just ages. Mr. Chairman, the question of the Thai levy, just some clarity there. The collection is moving to SARS. Just to get back a bit, many of the taxes have an intention to achieve a certain end, which is not necessarily revenue raising. And I think this is one. This is one where scrap tires are a huge environmental problem. So the question is, it's going to come into SARS. How is it going to get back into the industry? Will any of it land up in general funds, basically, in a loose kind of way? Or will it all be reinvested and used for that purpose? Then the medical tax credit. I'm getting quite a few, not a lot, a handful of people who really feel aggrieved by the low level compared with actual medical aid fees that have to be paid. And I know this is a big subject, but is anyone looking at that or should we be looking at it? The question of CGT, I know Cecil is saying it's been phased in since 2001, but the fact is that capital gains tax is very seldom something that individuals have to deal with. So there's no phasing for the individual. The individual just suddenly gets a huge amount added to their taxable income. So the question really is the phasing over, or is this going to keep creeping up until it reaches 100%? Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Mr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First,
afternoon.
On the slide on page 19 that shows you the number of taxpayers, etc. My comment is, I think this is probably the most important slide that you can look at every year as a country. This will surely show whether we're making progress, getting people employed. Page 19, to show that we have out of 60 million people, 13.7 million that are basically getting any form of organized income or formalized income. So we should be trying to, as a government, monitor that is constantly growing. But I still, I mean, everywhere, that's far too low. The capital gains tax, my only comments there is we've really got to look at the inflationary increase for people's profits. That's what makes the tax so unfair. So you buy a house, my first house I bought was $100,000. And when you retire one day at 70 and house mother was 5 million rand, you know, that's a lot of capital gains taxes that you're going to be paid if you don't have some form of inflation adjustment or into the base cost. We've really got to look at that going forward. Then on the tire levy,
also, how are they fungible? All resellers have to register for that, like I'm a VAT for, or will it be the wholesalers, or will it be the manufacturers, etc.? Because a little bit of admin nightmare there. And on that side on page 30, about the motor vehicle emissions tax, if this is a tax to encourage consumers to use more fuel-efficient, low-carbon emitting vehicles, why would a double cab pay a higher rate? Because that emission is safe, so it's indirectly a form of a luxury tax, or what is the reasoning behind that? And on the exchange control and the BEP process, if you are under investigation by SOF, can you still apply for regulation by SOF? And vice versa, SOF already investigates who the SOF is it? You know, because there's one application for it, you might not qualify under one section, but you could qualify for the disclosure program under the second one. And then the key word is authorized and unauthorized. There are many legal foreign bank accounts. And the question obviously is, people are going to want to know, is my bank account legal or illegal? So if in doubt, must apply to have it clarified. And obviously if you've got a legal bank account, for instance, if you have money in the United Kingdom, you're earning no interest, so you're not breaching anything in the SOF because you can't pay back some SI of that account in the UK. You know, business accounts and private accounts, whatever. But those are illegal, so I mean the principle is even I said that is it illegal, is it illegal? You know, and I'm asking that question, it's far more informed than most people. Because we've had a big publicity or public relations issue, maybe you need a section to deal with it to give people some form of advice. You know, what is legal and what is illegal? So if you worked overseas, legitimate you, whatever, you can have a bank account there. As long as you disclose your residence in South Africa, my understanding of the tax, etc. Okay, cool. And then the last question is on the trust, or the second loss. I think there's some wording left off of that middle section. Please, at the moment, ensure that the assets transferred through a loan to a trust are included in the state of the founder death, and blah, blah, blah. So if you pay donations tax, are you going to pay donations tax and then you die, it's going to be added to your estate? Clearly, that's not right. I think I remember the first in the bill somewhere, it said something about if you haven't charged interest on it or something like that. Can you just clarify that? Because I don't think the intention is to take out the donations tax and then include it in the estate as well. It doesn't make sense. And no, I don't like messing with trust because it's been around since Roman law. And, I'm one of those old accounts that like trust. And the last in the sugar tax. Also, the intention here is to try and help people live a healthier life. But this is intended as a tax, so it won't, the money won't, is not intended at this stage to be ring-fenced, to be applied back to national health or something like that. Or is it maybe being intended to be a ring fence that this money will go to the cost of health care in South Africa specifically. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, next week.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, there is just one concern I have before the question, before I could ask the other questions, is that my view is that when we are considering a policy, a fiscal policy review, it's very important for us to have a clear sense of what is happening with the monetary policy. It's also very important for us to link it directly with the government spending priorities. And the reason why I'm saying that, Chair, I think it's because the current economic environment is kind of imposing that on us, that you know, we have to be looking not necessarily only or at the fiscal policy and increasing of tax and what have you, but we also have to balance that with the current situation and the unemployment rates that we have in the country. I know that it's very broad, but I think it's very important for us to keep that in mind. Having said that, I think the Panama expose is good for the developing countries in particular, and because where we are is the reality that if the Panama expose did not happen, the possibility of us, you know, getting into knowing what is happening in terms of how much people are hiding, wherever, would have been very difficult. Notwithstanding, I am saying, in as much as I understand, like Patiala was saying, that Panama has decided itself is not, doesn't want to be part of the international agenda, but I'm saying the escalator itself, to me, I think it's a positive thing. And I also do think that in the real world, we do need to give a price incentive. I know that two people to come forward and disclose. You know, in the real world, people, if you don't give people something, you are actually, you might be pushing them further from you. And I think that I think the, as members, we should also be appreciative of. Okay, then my question, having said that, my question is that, one, I'm not sure what is actually what are we saying about what is the current picture in terms of you know, balancing the fiscal policy and monetary policy. I mean, we have the other thing. On the other hand, they've been increasing the inflation, and I mean, it's going up. Yeah, the record interest rates. And I'm saying that then we are coming here on this other hand. We are considering the fiscal review, and which is going to, obviously, we are considering to up the taxes, you know. And somehow I'm not sure if we consider all this we sufficiently, because I know you have it there, but I'm not sure if we sufficiently consider all these competing and contradictory priorities. And maybe I would like you to probably assist me in understanding whether we are bettering this, and what informs our choices that we are making in this fiscal framework review, what informs that choice. And two, Chair, there is something that, you know, when it comes to this, the property market, sometimes I'm very cautious about us coming up with something that is going out there saying we are increasing the taxes, the transfer duties on properties about 10 million. Because the reality of the situation now from where I am seated, and obviously I have no empirical data before me, but where I live, I know that properties in that range, the stock there is just sitting there. There's no uptake on the stock. I mean, people simply are not spending in that category right now, because of the number of factors that we have, the economic factors that we have. Now, why do we have to go into the space where we know very well that we are likely to be getting significant increase in the revenue, you know, as a result of that? And I'm not sure if our intention is to say, if you are rich, you are going to be punished for it. I'm not sure if that's the message that we are going to, we are reporting here. And Chair, please, this is consistent with your communist philosophy. I'm just saying, you know, on the other hand, the reason why I am saying that is that as much as possible, we want to make, oh, Chair, I'm so sorry, I don't know, it's the first time ever Chair has appeared my phone on in the meeting. Never, Chair, ever. You know that. Chair, you know, the thing is, I'm saying here, the reality is that a lot of money is sitting in private hands. Now, if you are going to be sending a message that is saying if you are rich, you are going to be punished. Unfortunately, these are a simple basic laws of economics. You know, you've got to do something. You shouldn't be avoiding to to position yourself in a way that, you know, you are there to simply punish the rich. You also have to be considering that we want that money that is sitting in private hands to come back into the economy. Otherwise, people simply sit with their cash, and they don't inject it in the economy. And we end up with a whole range of social effects as a result of that. So I'm saying, if we consider this, especially with respect of this particular tax, this transaction fee increase on properties above 10 million, because my view is that those properties in any way are hitting most of them. Even especially where I come from in Hebrew, I know that there are properties that have been advertised there for I don't know how long. They are just hitting them. There's no uptake. There's so much stock on that, on those properties. And if we are going to be basing our assumptions on something that we know in any case that it may not happen, I'm not, or it's going to have very little, and you also acknowledge that it's going to have, it's not going to have that significant impact. I'm not sure if we consider that. The other thing, Chetes, I wanted to get clarity on, you know, again on the property aspect, we are saying on properties from 1.2 million to 1.7 million, the tax adjustment that we are looking at there is 15,000%. And below there, from 170 or whatever, to 2.5 to 2.8, is 45 plus 8%. Now, my question is, when we are saying 6%, is this 6% calculated after you have minus the 15,000 or the specific threshold, or is it on the original capital of that property? I'm not sure if I'm clear. Yeah, I want to get clarity on that one. Because this, I think we, as much as possible, we need to prevent ambiguities as much as possible. Because when we come with these ambiguities, sometimes they don't work in our favor. And again, I also wanted to understand, why is it that we are not just coming up with the percentage, or you know, just come up with the percentage on it, and give the threshold of 15,000 first, and then, you know, but obviously you may say that, you know, that those, that's the bracket that you are dealing with, and therefore maybe it will vary. But I am saying maybe there has to be clarity on this one, so that we are clear why you are doing that. The other thing, Jay, I also want to know, the VAT expenses have been in the public domain, people have been debating it, and there's been a lot of arguments for and against that. That probably is about time that we consider that. Where do we stand right now, or at least in the 2016 fiscal proposition, what are we saying? And what are the indications? What are the various stakeholders saying about this? And notably, I know that the Labour is always most vocal on this particular one. And also, I would imagine that also, even myself being from the African National Congress, I'm always worried about, you know, what is, you know, the poor, we still want to make sure that their basket, food basket, is still affected as little as possible, you know, especially on basic commodities. If you could clarify that one. There is something that I want you to probably, that I would like probably Treasury to comment on, and that is our choice of expansionary fiscal policy. You know, whether that is speaking to, I mean, if we are going to say in tax cut, and I'm appreciating the table that you presented today, that it's a very difficult situation, because where we are in South Africa, I think, you know, you, although I saw on recently chair that, you know, we are now called as a developed countries on websites, you know, I saw it. And in fact, my computer, in some websites, that's what they're saying, but the reality of the situation is that we are still trapped in your 3-year kind of economy. You know, you have your first, second, and third, you know, and somehow we have to, when we are dealing with these kind of issues, we need to factor those realities of our own country. And if one could be clarified on that specific aspect as well. And Chair, there was something also that was said here, which was something that, this thing, Jay, is that there's been, I mean, over the weekend, there's been reports that obviously we are not, the chances of us getting going into the genetic test is something that's not necessarily going to be happening in the short term at least, because we still some notice whatever. But the concern that I have is that our cost of borrowing is inevitably going to go up. And that speaks to our government spending. And how are we balancing those two right now? You know, because if our cost of borrowing is going to be severely affected, because there was, in fact, I think there was, in most of the articles that have been across board, everybody was saying South Africa has to watch, you know, seriously, the cost of borrowing is going to be to increase. But that also has speaks directly to our expenditure as government, our expenditure priorities, if maybe we can get clarity on that specific one. And Chair, I wanted to get clarity on the limited window period for the special voluntary expose disclosure, and whether if that's that it was at that period that we are setting ourselves, I think they were set about, Is 6 months sufficient? I'm not looking for victims here. I mean, I was socialized by Eunice Karim and communist culture, but I've subsequently become a realist, you know? And I am so sorry for you, Eunice, you've done your hard work. And indoctrinate me as a child, you know. And each time when I'm saying these kind of statements, I always feel guilty when Eunice is in the house, because I can see him looking at me like that. That's not what he taught you, you know. So Jay, I actually wanted to check if that is something that we need to, if we've seriously considered that period. I know that as much as possible. We also don't want it to be too long, but also 6 months I think is too short, but maybe we do have a good reason for that. And Jay, that is my favorite one. And I've raised this thing over and over again. You know, we are yet coming up with other incentives on education and training, and we are considering them. But my question, my concern is, unless we begin to confront the reality that in South Africa we are spending so much on education, but the quality of output is simply not pleasing. I'm not saying it's not happening, but it's not pleasing. The reality right now, especially if we are talking about, even if we are going to be saying to companies, we are incentivizing to forgiving bursaries and so forth, if we are not going to be addressing the fact that over 60% of university students, for example, either drop off or first edition, drop off, get this student on the basis of academic performance and all that, and we do not address the deficit that exists between high schooling and university, or high schooling and tertiary education, we are going to have a serious problem. And the reason why I'm saying this, that as somebody who is I'm associated with my A levels in Zimbabwe. In Zimbabwe, your schooling is about 13 years. In South Africa, it's 12 years. And why are we not considering looking at that aspect, where the other year you use it to ground students, so that you are not even on providing these kinds of incentives, but these incentives are getting into a living pot. You are simply putting money there only not to get the result. I mean, and I always say, you know, I love Bobby's that quotation of Bobby, who said, you know, you can't celebrate the surgery when you're, and say my surgery, the operation was very successful, but the patient is dead, you know. So I love that one. Yeah, so I'm saying, if you're not looking at that, my concern is that you're going to keep on coming up with this incentive, coming up with the official, coming up with all these, by the way, I'm raising them because they do speak to our fiscal framework review. And when we are doing that, we have to be tightening our belts, probably creating an incentive to universities that are, I don't know how are we going to do that, but creating an incentive for those universities that have quality output, that are, you know, that are producing, you know, better results or something like that. I'm just saying there are a lot of things that we need to balance there, Chair. And this thing also goes with the learnerships. And the learnerships, I'm worried, again, this is not a competency, maybe this is a place in the budget issue, but it does bother me that with learnerships, students, I've had a lot of students who have probably honors, you know, BSc finance at the university, they go get an internship and when they get to the employment place, because of these incentives, all they are doing is just to do photocopying and get sent from pillar to post and that kind of thing. And they are not necessarily being affirmed, you know, as people, and they are not getting those skills. I know that this is not your area of focus right now, but I think these issues are equally important because when we are providing those incentives, we need to understand what we want to get out of this incentive. What is the point of providing an incentive, but it's not, you know, it's not translating into desired results? I think it's just a concern.
Some guidance to Treasury on our side, but I'm in the joke. See, on so to speak, colleagues, please realize that actually there's no rule that says who should get what time, but instinct and fairness, and it's about the amount of time of this. We don't need that time. So, you know, you can come back to the problem. So, and although we do prioritize the smaller towns, because Hong Kong and others in Cornwall, they can't come here, not because they don't want to, because they have no choice. They have represented, yeah, you're many committees, you're working for it, aren't you?
Yes.
Yeah. And let me tell you, without sort of like fitting into your subtext, there's no such thing. Frankly, both you and Hong Yi, I really feel honest, sincere, whatever time of these people may take. It would be very good to just contribute, because when you do, you do make some very good contributions here. And I'll notice you in the office and say, I'll be serious. Look, my generation, we are moving on. You know, when I see you, I don't agree with you necessarily. I've seen you on TV several times, and you really do impress me. You know, and I'm thinking, I don't do patronize you, but quite frankly, you know, I keep thinking, hey, I wish this guy would come more to our committee. So you can take twice the amount for coaching. Make up for all the time you're not
there. Eddie, the ruling party, this is today. Get around, Chef. Chef, thank you very much. I'll ask my questions later because I don't know what has been covered in the questions that have been asked already, so I don't want to repeat what has already been said. But then on the issue of fiscal track, I remember you spoke about track at the beginning of your presentation. You know, as a side comment, Chair, I think it's very difficult, it's very hard to be a public representative in South Africa at this point in time. Because firstly, for instance, you get an increase that is below the inflation rate, which will naturally push you up towards the higher income tax bracket. But at the same time, because of the system you've used, it means you are even corroding and eroding our real income even further. So it's a double win for us. Maybe I should go to the private sector where the increase is actually more than 10%. Similar. Yes. I got to mention this, to talk about it in our debate in the House, the issue about the, I think you've given enough hints, even the budget review. I think it's page 48, 47, something of the budget review, where you make it clear, you do a comparison between the different countries, you know, what their red rates are, and so on, and you even have a sentence that tells us that you're considering increasing it next year. Without stating it explicitly, there's a reason that way you compare. I don't have my budget review document in front of me. But the issue is, for me, I said, if you go to the Eastern Cape, for example, the English breakfast there, call it our English breakfast, is bissel and white bread. That's nice soup, tomatoes and onion and so on. Right? That means we are exempting brown bread, but our people are eating white bread. Not that I'm saying we should actually change
and that exempt white bread from VAT as an example. But I think it's more a question, are we communicating to our people? Well, our people know basic foodstuffs actually exempted from payment. That's the question. I don't think they are. Right? And because I think if they were, some of them obviously are basic issues that you cannot survive without, like your staple food. But I'm saying if they were, they would be saving money. Because then you'd be able to actually shift money from white bread in this instance to brown bread, etc., etc. But I think also when I was, you know, doing my preparations for the budget speech, looking at what's happening, the trend internationally and so on, the question when it comes to that, the question that came to my mind is, do we get to a point where we review the list of our basic food items or items that we accept from that? Because people's tastes and preferences over time do change. So we don't want to sit around with an old list that no longer protects the poor. I saw one example. I can't remember the country where, because most of the people, I think, were using bicycles or something, the poor, as mode of transport, I think they exempted a bicycle from that, something along those lines, which I thought it was creative, but I can't remember the name of the country right now, from the top of my head. The other issue has to do, obviously, coming back to this issue of fiscal trade, I think it was a very smart move, but there was a smart move that came at the expense of us who are public representatives. We should reconsider the future. I'm kidding. And there is obviously the issue about higher levy. I don't know. I think you have an exhaustive list of all the hires and what you intend to do in the bill itself. Maybe this question was asked before. I don't know. If it was, grant me atonement for taking it back to something that you already dealt with. But the question I want to ask is, did we think that all this, including that, tend to be recursive of nature, that I think there was even a report from the Parliamentary Budget Office who suggested that at some point, that they considered a study that was done at UCT, which showed that even the fuel levy might have a disproportionate burden on the poor. Have we considered maybe exempting some of the hires, say, for example, that are used by taxis? I don't know the technical way that one would have to do it. That are used by public transport, maybe taxes and so on from the tire levy, because obviously that's going to be passed on to the poor. As soon as the levy is introduced, obviously the taxi drivers are going to increase their taxi fares, and the rest is history. Thank you.
Okay,
look,
please.
Sure, now,
okay. Thank you.
Firstly, well, the other thing I wanted to say is that obviously the ANC, like all parties, has certain frameworks within which members of the party disagree. So sometimes it's quite clear the framework is narrow. So members can express the point of view, it's fine, and that's going to be allowed. It's like a brainstorming session. And then there's a majority decision within the ANC. But on the issues that are before us right now, we are a pro-national democratic movement. And not that I'm responding to my question, but a general point I should make, obviously our piece and our feeling. This is not obviously, my own role, if you look at me in sharing committees, I'll present my case and study groups we've quite defeated. Only once last year, I really lobbied, one of them was not here. Remember that issue? I really did, I didn't know. But it was not just Communist Party, it had to do with the public sector organization, and you don't make the change. I don't think you like it. A full-time person, I remember that issue. And I fought for that and told the minister, the then minister, that was the only time, I mean, I didn't open it, but I was a bit surprised when somebody else whom I didn't lobby, that was the one time where I was cheated off in the study group, but I looked out, I guess. So basically, I don't know, I don't really know what the answers are to many of the issues that Magosi and others have raised. The one thing, though, that we, it's fine to raise issues about the fiscal framework here, but we already have a report from the committee on the fiscal framework, correct? With the issue that Makosi raised, some of them belong there, but it's nothing wrong with raising it here. But the interesting thing she raised, which is correct, actually, you only look at the fiscal framework, you don't look enough at monetary policy, she talks about that. As a committee, I'm not saying you guys don't do it. We don't. So I think, of course, that's a very valuable point. I hope you wanted to say something. Thank you.
Yeah.
Sorry, I forgot. Why are you guys so servile? If you've been allowed to speak, and in fact, okay, I'm going to stop. I'm telling you right away. If this committee will agree that provided the MPs have spoken, is it like student time, you're allowed to speak, because you can take it an extra. Right? So you can raise it, I know you're new, but you're free to ask anything you want. Sorry, he's attacked it, but okay.
Thank you, Chair. Morning, honourable morning, colleagues. I just want to add the point on this special voluntary discharge program, as honourable member has said. I think for me, there has been a VDP before. I just want to understand what were the lessons that have been learned from them that should be taken forward. The other point, Chair, is the objective behind it. I think honourable member has raised what the objective behind it. Now I'm trying to bring the automatic exchange information program. Is there a thing, the objective that should be addressed by the automatic exchange program? Can that address some of the problems there? Of course, I know it's a quite a growing concept. The other point, I think the VDP, in a sense, somehow sacrifice in revenue, if you look at it in collective spend, to get certain behavior in order or to get certain understanding. The point I want to raise is that does National Treasury have a qualitative and a quantitative outcome target? So if, in this case, how much are we expect to achieve or do we have specific in that subject? The other point is on the excess duties as the often known as sin tax. I think there has been a lot of concerns, questions around what is the purpose. Is the money being, as honourable opponents raised there, is the money being used for addressing the problems in that area? It's put on the trace and I think it's covered there. But now, I think it probably it's a point that could be discussed with the Appropriation Committee, but I think it should be addressed. So we are increasing these by bringing sugar tax in. What is the purpose? Is there going to be a measure that assess whether it's been used or not, the problems that you can afford? And whether that's effective as well, Chair. Thanks, Chair.
Yeah, I was saying that there is no like party political position. We have to process these things. Very quickly, what I want to ask is, you see, at the moment, things are pretty bad. You're more acutely than people like me, right? We're not getting investments. Private sector is jittery for a variety of reasons. I saw in the business day that the largest chunk of exit of money has occurred in the last quarter that is acknowledged by some agencies. Now, I understand all of that. So, you know, the sum total of what we do here in the proposals before us, is it not going to exacerbate the anxieties of the private sector when we need them, you know, very much? I say that on one hand, but on the other hand, we also can't let people get away when they're committing wrong things. From my own view, for what it's worth, and it's not I don't think the majority of this will agree with me, but I'm just asking. I don't really understand what you do in this VDP. I have your press statement last night. So for example, you simplify for those of us who are not very experienced in this area of finance and insurance, and how harsh and low compensation, or whatever it is, but we have to do our job here. Yeah? Let's say you've got a 10 run, right? Let's see in some way, 10 run, 10 run, right? So what are you guys going to do? Half of it, you're going to allow me to keep. Is that what you're saying? The other half, you're going to tax. So of the 10 run, how much will I end up losing? In other words, is it clear that the way you're going to penalize them will disincentivize them from doing this sort of thing again? At the same time, people raise the issue of what's legal, even if it's immoral, and what's illegal, so that's a counterweight issue. I think nothing we can do if it's legal and immoral. Well, we're not the church here, or the mosque, or the temple, or the synagogue. But, you know, if it's illegal, hey, I think you must go for that. You must go for that. Well, why? When we desperately need resources for infrastructure. So it's good for the private sector also. So that's my set of issues. I don't really know whether even the majority in the ANC will agree with me, but I'm just saying, I'm throwing it open, whether the majority decides in the ANC will get bound by it. Then there are some issues I don't understand. Right? You're choosing the date. It's maybe because others are more familiar. So some of these questions can be dealt outside. If it's simply me, who's like an irritation thing, maybe for the Francis. So you don't have to answer all of these questions. In your press release, which you sent out to members, you talk about an initial no-name approach. So in other words, if I've got 10 runs, I can send my lawyer to you without revealing who I am. Why do you do that? Surely you should be monitoring your Mr. Ismail Khalil, because I've done this terrible thing, right? Two, you talk about settlers, S-E-T-T-L-O-R-S, in bullet three of your press release, which you sent to members, by the way, all of us went to read it. What were settlers, right? Then thirdly, under leave granted on page 2, under the FVDP. So only 50% of the total amount. So what happens to the other 50%? I don't understand. Why using 1st of March, presumably that's the beginning of the financial year for the previous year, right? Then you talk about 1st of March 2010. This releases the previous EDP. I don't know, I think it is. Then an interest charge beginning of 1st of March 2010. I don't understand under waiver of no understatement penalties will be levied. The existing EDP, how is this distinct and different from that? It's the same thing, Tasani, there's a lot of lessons you learn from that, and to the extent you didn't learn any positive lessons, or when they get to whatever, how do you incorporate some current bill before that? The other things, I don't really know what I'm asking, and I won't bore you with them. Then the carbon tax bill. We have communicated both your DG to your minister, having a meeting, Sumashal and myself as your minister. This committee might have forgotten, but majority, in fact, all of us agree. We will not be able to deal with the current bills we have before us. So we've got the financial sector regulation bill. I've just got an SMS from another ministry to say, you know, nobody sees they have an issue. They will sort this out with you guys. Huh? One government, one ANC. Cabinet will sort of issues up there. We will need. We don't get involved. So mom, I need to brief you. I've just got an SMS now. So basically what we're saying is, with the FFR bill, we're going to take a whole month off. Hi, Mana. Don't you have something more interesting than listen to boring tax issues? I take it you're not here for the volunteers to close the program. So bank of Baghdad account, if you check it, your bank of Somalia account, your bank of Zimbabwe account, volunteering. But now, you know, the FSR bill, we more or less agreed that we will focus for one full month when we come back, right? Then we come to the council, but annual report. Now, then we go into DPS. Then we've got the insurance bill. So, what is the point of bringing a carbon tax bill this year? Aren't you going to make the public say, I'm a bit jittery? They've already been lobbying me. I spoke last week to a business community of 25 people. All of them made the carbon tax. I said, as far as I know, it's not on the agenda for the parliamentary committee. This is an issue we need to raise again and again. I've been raising it since 2001. You see, Parliament decides its program. This committee, for example, I mean, whether one individual or one, I could say, please decide the problem, not you. You come to us and tell us you can't do certain things when the minister is in Mongolia. You say, fine, we understand why he's in Mongolia. But you don't always agree if he's in Mongolia. When the DG is totally over, you must send the DG if he's not able to come. But the thing is, the truth is, although we try to shape our own programs, I've raised this with two previous people. You dictate the program. You decide what books you're going to play. Sydney Mufamadi was able to say, no, we want this municipal systems amendment bill before. The tradition leadership bill later. Do you know what I said to it? We've done it for Erwin on Infracom. I think it's time the committee told the executive, I'm going to speak to the chief. No, you're not bringing the carbon tax bill to Parliament this year. The first step is next Tuesday, Shal and I are meeting the minister. And we're going to tell him, unless this committee be not having the carbon tax bill this year. What performance agreements you may get, okay? Whoever is responsible, the DG will look and see, done it. For that purpose, you can do it. What will be the point of bringing the carbon tax bill now? Right? We, as this committee, will have to be convinced. Even in next year. You engage more with the people who are up in arms about it. Let me alert you, we've been asked to go on a study tour, and I said only when the bill is tabled, to stop. They came to see me. And I said, what's the point of coming now? Let them table the bill, let's see what the bill is about, let's have a briefing on the bill. Then when we come to visit you, we are better able to put pointed questions to you. So that's our agenda. So what I'm saying, colleagues, is I think we must be part of the executive, actually. You can't just come dump things here. And you don't think it's not something that we can handle. So your insurance bill, they must decide, which you can decide, where we can engage around, we'll drop your insurance bill. Although we like it because it's linked to the FSR bill, right? Why don't we do it together? So the earlier we can look at your carbon tax bill is maybe April next year. Then the issue of the sugar tax bill, personally I support it, so I don't think the aim to get a position on it. But how do you call it an obesity bill? Because you know, like if you have a fiscal policy, you should really talk about if you think the diabetes, cholesterol, what is high blood pressure and all. To call it an obesity bill is also making like a judgmental issue. You see, in a certain country in the East, now hang on, let me finish. In a certain country in China, the people are very small boned, and they look small, right? It's a genealogical, maybe even, I don't know, structural, dietary, historical, and a series of things, okay? And then if you look, you get my point, Ali. If you look at somewhere else in the world, people are generally physically bigger, not because they necessarily choose to be, but because of the same situation. Some people have small feet. There's a certain community in a certain part, a very large number of people who have very small feet, I'm told. And one can sense they probably do have small feet. Not that I've looked at their feet all the time, but you know, you eat balls and books and so on. Now, the thing is, they have small feet because of all these reasons. It's not inherent in them. They didn't choose a small feet. They didn't say when they were in mommy's womb, hey, I want small feet. Right? And you know, in that community, they said that the men, being Texas as men generally are, choose women partly on the side of the feet. Now, there's all those situations. I don't like this term obesity. I really prefer, you know, you guys to use a more politically palatable term. You know, I know Aaron Motsoaledi goes around saying that, right? Every time you see him over the radio or something, he speaks passionately about this, from what I know. But I don't think we should use that term personally, but hey, you know what, that's just my view. Then on the issue of employment tax incentive review, this is something our committee agreed to do. When are we going to do this? Actually, we want a discussion about the thing. In fact, I think a DA asked for it at one stage, but we also, in fact, the DA thinks, you know, almost everything they asked for, we already had in mind, but never, issued statements and things for them. Without them, we never thought of asking for an investment plan. Oh, no, no, we had to have one particular individual here. But actually, on the tax incentive, it was Makosi Otandi who somebody has raised it last year. We did have one, for those of you who are new members, like the three here, we did have one sitting towards the beginning of last year when Dio and them were here. And that was a decision taken by the ANC, not the DA, to have that. Right? And we agreed to have a follow-up. So, on this matter, I just need to alert members that we did agree to come back to this thing. So we welcome it. And if we can slide it in somewhere before you bring the formal review to us, we would like to look and think about it. We slotted in. We have slotted in basically, yeah. We need to talk to, so we have slotted in the latest program, the PIC, GPAA, and GEP now. Right? And we've taken out the FSR bill again, yet again. So you see, the FSR bill gets put further and further back. So, other issues, look, my time's running out. I'm bored listening to myself. Mr. Lee, do you want to say anything? You wait until the answers. Okay. Yeah, go for it.
Something has come up as well, as you were. I did speak to it, but I think there's something that they are saying. I want to hear what Ms. Shasha is going to say. We seem to be always accommodative when it comes to transgression of the law by deep business and money people, right? And this voluntary disclosure thing just falls into that category. And that's a question which is out there. If it's a person who's poor and so on, we'll be going after him or her. But with the business and so on, you know, the question of the data, well, the 2010 World Cup and so on, we can try to get a good goal. At length, we try and bend backwards until we break our backs. Why are we doing that? Because my question again, is this an illegal thing? That's very important. And then if it's an illegal thing, I think it should be dealt with as illegal activity.
Okay. If I, an ordinary taxpayer, don't do what I should do, you guys give a huge penalty. Not that I've ever been in that situation, but this thing, an average sort of person, especially if somebody is newly emergent, not familiar enough with the tax issues, you're also ruthless. And so you should be one level. So why are you, for what I'm thinking, a bit soft?
Although one takes into account, Makosi is looking for the right balance, but Makosi is saying is correct also. I said that at the outset. Makosi, I don't know what the right balances are. I agree with many of the things she said, but it's also a countervailing issue. And I'm sure Makosi, as she is here, will also adjust. It's like finding the right balance, not either or. Not either. No, Makosi, I'm not disagreeing with you. Yeah, Tandy must say something.
Thank you, sir. Sir, I want to make a reference when we discuss matters of tax before we create a situation where Tandy can come with a different political opinion and Tandy comes with a different political opinion and then don't assist us to do what we're supposed to do on our behalf, collect as much as we can and identify those who, when we were discussing issues of tax havens, before to get each and every cent, it doesn't matter whether it was put away by a black or a green or a yellow person, as long as it was done outside the laws of South Africa, it should be but I think we agree here in principle. So I want to suggest that this you open up for that in discussion, because I tried to strike that balance when I said let's discuss the principle of ignorance and deliberate intention. Unless it was bringing back the discussion on what Lloyd has brought on the table, then I don't know.
I also understand what you say. See, what I'm saying at the moment is an informal briefing, right? And we are brainstorming. There's no party political. As I explained at the beginning, there's something that's clear. We have guidance, NEC resolutions, and or more particularly Manga Ong and all that. We have come, Baba. So we can defer within the framework of that. On these issues, there's nothing really that guides us clearly. And we need to find the right balance. That's what it's about. The issue isn't that we should get back all that should come back. It's how you apply your percentages of penalties and fees. What percentage? So we can agree entirely with Tandy. But we may differ whether it should be 40% or 20% or 30%. If we may differ on whether if it's this type of offshore asset you have or income, that side, which you... So those are things. But I don't think we're disagreeing with the principle Tandy said. And remember, this is a brainstorming session. We are not giving you guidelines because we are not likely to emerge with them right now. We will get Dumasani, our experts, and others to do some work on this area. Then we will discuss it further, and then we will be able to give you guidelines by which time we are ready also to make amendments to the bill as appropriate. All I'm saying is that these are complex issues, and this is like a brainstorming session. It's like a workshop more than... Like tomorrow we'll be taking decisions on the pickup of which must come to the moment. Here we are brainstorming. Thank you. So I think everything that people have said is useful and valuable. It helps each other to get a better understanding. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. And I'll get my colleagues here to respond to the big issues. And if you have them out, please let me know. I think, Chair, let me say that the books that we have today are obviously very narrow in their scope. And we will come to that. But what we try to do is to make sure we have a general discussion on tax. And that's why, to put my lobbying point, we always want it to be part of the 10-day process that you have on budget. Years ago, it used to be a specific session, because obviously when a minister comes following year after the budget, it's at a higher level. And I think just on the question that members have asked, I mean, tax is one area where because people have to pay, people are always going to ask questions. You know, those who pay feel the level is too high, they rightly would, not just them, everybody would rightly question the quality of expenditure. The issue of tax morality is important. And ultimately, I mean, taxation is even about nation building in the sense that people give government money. We as government have their money in trust. We expect them to spend it on health, education, and we're not going to deal with all the issues, but say some of the issues raised, is it being well spent? You know, is certainly the critical issue for any government to consider. I think, too, to get transparency, we also want to make sure that incentives are also looked at as hard, because at least with expenditure, as an appropriation bill, and it goes through various parliamentary processes. This committee doesn't deal with, I know, besides on the budget issues, it gets dealt with an appropriation committee, but it, as you know, it also goes through various committees. But what doesn't go through a similar process are tax incentives. And these tend to be sort of very okay, and because there's no time, they're not time-bound, like we have done with the employment tax incentives, they tend to get forgotten. Okay. So that's why, what table is it? That we publish every year what's the approximate tax expenditure. And I think it's a very important table, and it's if you go to, I know not all members don't have the budget review, but it's table C1 on page 141, which tells you, for example, on the personal income tax side, there's 53 billion lands in 2013-14 that the state foregoed, right, as income. If you take corporate income tax, you're looking at about 4.6 billion. This income comes with a lag because it's after SARS has processed a sufficient number of returns and so on. And, you know, if you look at the total is what, says 134 billion rand, almost 135 billion rand, which is 15% of gross tax revenue. So certainly as Parliament, it's music to my ears if the committee does look at something like the employment tax incentive, you know, very carefully. But I would appeal that you should do that with all tax incentives, because I promise you, the very people who object to that, there are tax incentives they are beneficiaries of, which I think are nowhere as transparent as some of the more recent tax incentives that we have. If you look at the budget, in fact, it's not just tax incentives. There was, government is doing a review of all incentives in the system, both tax and non-tax. And I think that that's quite an important part. So I think getting to the issues of tax morality is critical, because if that gets weakened and, you know, there's poor spending and there's no accountability, it's the best way to make sure that people don't feel like paying their tax. And then people structure. So a lot of the people who don't pay their taxes can do it legally. So that's tax avoidance. Okay. Others, of course, do it through evasion, and that's illegal, so it's tax evasion. The problem, of course, is in and having amnesties, and I share on Bob Bukhereji's view that, you know, even in the treasury we have strong debates, because you want to have an amnesty once, and in South Africa we've had a general amnesty, but it wasn't for corporate in 2000. And what year was it? The previous one, and the temporary VDP and the.
So if you want to be historical, we had one back in 95, 96, because logically people who didn't want to pay tax to prop up the previous regime, well, you needed to assist them to come back into the system. Then in 2003, we had an exchange control amnesty, because that followed on our introduction of a worldwide system of taxation in 2001. And that was a full-on amnesty. I mean, essentially you paid 2% for tax and all local offences, and then it got you off your entire tax bill. There was something similar on the exchange control side. You paid 5 or 10% of the value of assets. Then what we then did in 2010 is we moved in the direction that several countries have, creating a voluntary disclosure program. Essentially, you come forward, you say, I have made a mistake, I have done something wrong, I on reflection have thought better of it, and I'd like to come forward and clean up. So essentially, why would you do something like that? Well, it's a lot easier if people come to you and tell you what they've done wrong than if you have to find them, and once you've found them, go through some pretty steep legal battle sometimes to actually pin them down and recover the cash. So essentially, it allows people to come clean, and we ran that in 2010 as a temporary measure. It worked pretty well. We had 18,000 odd applications. We got 4.3 billion rands worth of tax. And so that was something that made sense. It was then incorporated as a permanent thing into the Tax Administration Act in 2010.
which then started running from 2012 when the Act became live. And this was a parliamentary question that was asked, I'm just looking at something that Mr. told you already. We've had 8,400 applicants in terms of that voluntary disclosure program and collected 6.3 billion in tax out of it. So that's the thinking in broad behind voluntary disclosure. But we can talk in detail as the special one later.
Yeah. And we will come to the special VDC, and I think members have asked us for how it will work and what we want to get. But I think there's 2 points that France has made. That a lot of these funds, some of it may be illegal, some of it may be, you know, you're not certain, okay? But here's an opportunity for people to come forward. And remember, with this particular one, especially if it's offshore, it is very difficult to find it. And so this is a game of cat and mouse. There's people who are, well, they will get away with it, so they continue to stay away. And I think we'd all agree, when we find them, they actually pay very punitive rates, okay? Sure, there are processes when people break the law on the prosecution side, but we don't deal with that, and I think there are challenges there that people don't get prosecuted enough when they do blatantly illegal things, including steal money, okay? Or if you look at the stories that go around, I mean, hopefully we need to improve the investigating capacity to make sure people are prosecuted and do end up in the chukis. That's the best way to make sure that people do it. I mean, it's part of the strategy to get people to do it. But lastly, we focus on getting people's affairs right if they come forward. And the continuing VDP means that we don't have to have an amnesty, but people can come forward. Now, what we will do, Chair, because I think though it's been done in the past, we'll try, and Johan and Franz, let's just do this. Let's just dig up all the old reports that we've had on the previous amnesties, the disclosure program that France has outlined. We've given you in detail, just a picture of what the amounts were, how many people applied. But we can certainly, there were for some of them pretty detailed reports that were put out. We'll try and get all of those and provide them to Parliament, because I think it's important also just to get it out there in the public domain. So the whole issue, I think, that Anbu Salehi has raised, yes, you know, the people tend to avoid, tend to be rich people, and especially to have offshore accounts, it tends to be very rich people, and that's why 6 months is enough, because I can assure you, they have lawyers and others doing this, looking at it, and when you have something like Panama in the news, I think it certainly acts as an incentive for people to come forward, because there really is, it's really becoming a world where it's difficult to hide private wealth if it's not being disclosed. However, having said that, it's impossible for us to reach out 100%, because aside from having, like, the tax treaties, they are very narrow. So, for example, it has, some people may have dual citizenship, for example, and they may have a different address when they open an account, say, in a country that they don't have a citizenship in. It's how their original documentation is, where it gets registered as a country. So you may well find that we may think somebody owes us in South Africa, but it may be that the disclosure goes to the UK, because it depends when people have registered. But look, for most people, the main point is if they've got funds outside, they are insecure, and almost the onus is on them to come forward. And I think this is a judgment call. Do we just make it easier for people to come forward? Because the benefit for us is that there will be a large amount of revenue, you hope. We were asked, do we know how much? No, we don't, because people who do things illegally don't tell you what they're going to do. So, you know, let's see what happens on that. And I think all the points taken, there's no final view on these things. I mean, that's why this matter is before Parliament. You have the right to say, perhaps we've been too generous, perhaps we shouldn't do it. But I think the judgment call, the Davis Tax Committee was very, pretty strong about this. And as I said, I think within the 6 months is enough because it's out in the news and people can prepare now for that. But we'll get into the detail of this. I wanted to say, Chair, that we certainly in tax policy don't want to create any impression that we're going for the rich, that you're increasing transfer duty and 10 million, blah, blah, blah. I think that though there are issues in the world on inequality, you had Thomas Piketty coming to South Africa, for example, delivering last year's Mandela lecture. And these issues are really important issues throughout the world. They deal with the gluing society, and certainly after 2008, inequality has increased in advanced economies. And I think the issue of taxing not just income, but wealth has come to the fore. And so, if you look at the Davis Tax Committee, they have been looking at estate duty and donations tax, which are really our only wealth taxes as such. But there are other proxies like capital gains. They're not quite wealth taxes. Certainly the transfer duty is one. And bear in mind, people don't pay VAT. So one could argue that, you know, the norm should be 14%. It depends how you look at it, but it is a transaction tax, which there are also economic arguments against transaction taxes. But you have to expect policy balance, I think, the many objectives, equity, taxing wealth, getting proxies to tax that, and obviously it is a judgment call. There's no one way of doing it. There are many different ways that one could do it. Chair, I want to deal just with other just more general questions, and so the team will certainly come on VDP, and I think Cecil can maybe, if there's anything more you want to talk about, who is taxing and so on. If you really focus, as I said, a lot is about changing behavior. It's about actually changing behavior in poorer communities. So not all our taxes are progressive. Our tax system is progressive. But for example, you may well find that the tax on tobacco or the excise duty on tobacco will probably be not progressive, but we don't want it to be progressive. We will want poor people also not to smoke. Okay? So you are changing the price. So if you look at specific taxes like those, the impact will be, it's very focused. Generally though, even where we have these non-revenue taxes, we don't ring fence. There are a few ring fence taxes, and the best example of them is the URF, Road Accidents Fund, and I think you see the problems when you have that, where you have a huge surplus in one, you have a huge deficit in the other, you can't move funds around. We think certainly it's best to appropriate money, because it goes through a process and people have to justify every year what they do. Whereas once you have a tax law and you say thou shalt collect so much, the amount just increases, and that's the challenge. In last year's budget, certainly, this was an issue that the unions were opposed to the concept of a tax holiday on the UIN. It's still up for discussion. It's mentioned in the budget review. And our approach is we really don't think ring fencing is an issue, but the issue is how do you then hold when you have a tire tax or you have the plastics tax? There were failures with the agency that was supposed to deal with it. I think those issues will come to the fore. So there's a tax morality issue. There's certainly the issue of accountability on the spending side. The accountability on the spending side is, I would almost say, is inherent to good tax policy. If you don't have it, you're going to find that your tax collection capacity will suffer. Okay, just on other issues, and I won't comment on VAT exemptions from white to brown bread. In fact, how intrusive should the state be? How much should the state say, thou shalt eat this and not that? Okay. There are public health issues, and the reality is most poor people actually eat probably white bread instead of brown, if the exemption is on brown. Again, these are issues we prefer the health department to come forward on, and other departments. So, Chair, we're not calling it an obesity tax. I think papers and in the panels telling to say, okay. And in fact, we not have a special bill on sugar. It will form part of the TLAB, or customs and excise. So we don't have a dedicated text for legislation for some of these proposals. And certainly, as you said, Minister Musaledi and them, you know, who are the prime movers behind this, don't see any problem with the word obesity. I think they see as a medical condition and as a disease, and we're not going to fight with them. We might know about economics, but not health issues. And if it's not PC, I guess that's where we should get them to deal with those issues. Yeah, on the issue, certainly, I mean, we can't tell Parliament what to do, certainly not. And I think that there may be program in challenges, but I do think that we would love to come to the committee and talk about the carbon tax. This is the only committee that hasn't looked at it. There's about 3 or 4 committees that are working on this, and I should say that on any tax, when you have the royalty, although it's not from a typology thing, it's not seen as a tax, the royalty, you will have people coming forward and say the earth is going to collapse. In this instance here, the world is going to collapse if we don't do something. South Africa has committed to certain targets. Yes, you mentioned one company, I'm not surprised. They are the second biggest emitter. So if they don't make a big noise, there's something wrong. We've taken with these taxes here 5 years. I think we have a reasonable proposal on the table, and I think that there's a need for certainty. The longer this matter hangs, it generates some certainty, and I would plead, and certainly we look at the tax process, to at least do a presentation on it. So you can actually see it's nowhere as onerous as people want to make it out to be. It is about changing behavior over 5 years. Yes, you are going to get all the emitters ganging up, but I think that, me personally, that now's the time to be bold, and we're not alone in doing that. This is the biggest challenge facing humankind, and I think South Africa has committed in Paris to certain commitments, and this is a primary tool that's going to help us get towards that objective. So I do think that any delay there would have serious implications, and it may well be a good idea, I think, to have a joint hearing with the other committees. Some of the committees have this as separate, you know, they call us to come to talk about it, but I do think that it's something that we'd like to engage and actually put on the schedule, because we do think it's quite a priority to at least have the legislation. The date of effect we can talk about, but certainly I think getting the legislation out is important. Chair, that's just the broad points I would like to make. I think maybe if we can deal with the BDP, I don't know, it's just so, I mean, there's a lot of questions, it's a bit difficult to answer all of them. But do you want us to be start with the BDP and give you...
Very quickly about time. Some of the questions are very general and they deal with some issues, so don't spend too much time. The issues that are directly relevant to the bill, focus on that. Secondly, there are people who signal they want to speak, so I've noted their hands. Can we just finish this round and then see how much of time we've got? I have to leave at about 10 to 1, so somebody else can share.
Okay. Maybe just before we get to the specific BDP, I don't know if my colleagues have anything to add on the general points, so let's get them out of the way.
I think let's do the BDP first. There's a couple of specific questions on sort of electricity and things like that, which I'd like to comment upon. Can I just, as a chair now, that's my prerogative in this case, 6.23, this is what we all agreed as a committee from our report on the fiscal framework. The committee fully supports the BDP, but having heard what stakeholders in the public hearing said, proposed that National Treasury consider this very well worded. We can say you should, because at that stage we felt, hey, what do we know? Considers expanding, we didn't stop them, the period to beyond the 6 months allocation. Some of our members were highly impressed by a professor who came here and said he served on your previous structure. And he said 6 months ain't workable. And then the members of the majority, I don't have a view on it particularly, but hey, who am I? Majority seem to think here the case, and they also from their own views felt that 6 months is not fine. So therefore we said you must consider. So is this guy was on your structure before? So he says it carries some weight. And then one or two others nodded in agreement. I don't know, one of the stakeholders from PwC or somebody. That's why we put it here. So we want to say a bit more about why you think 6 months is tenable.
Right, I think I've been nominated for this one. Thank you, Chair. Indeed. So why the VDP? Why does one have a VDP and why does one have a special VDP? Well, clearly the idea here is that we'd like to collect money now. We'd like to get people into the tax base so that we can collect money going into the future. All right, so we want them on board. And really, for the people involved, it gives them a clean slate. So then, why wouldn't you have something like this? I mean, the point's being made, CRS is coming, or isn't all this information going to be arriving at SARS doorstep anyway? It's a very fair point. The thing to bear in mind is CRS is going to be implemented in two phases, so 2017-2018, so it's not all going to happen immediately. The second point to be made is that is only the starting point of the discussion when it comes to SARS. Now we know there's an asset. Now the question is that a legitimate asset or not a legitimate asset? Once we've decided, okay, that's something that's not been on our radar screens before, we need to now interrogate it a bit more, then we get into the questions of, well, perhaps it was an inheritance, perhaps it was something that wasn't taxable. And then you end up in quite detailed legal disputes about where did this thing come from. Now, immediately, we're on the back foot because this is an asset that's somewhere else. It's not information we have right here. So we're going to have to deal with other tax authorities and trying to find out where did this asset come from, how long has it been there. So there's quite a lot of work to be done there. So yes, it's information that you will be able to use. Yes, it's information that SARS will be able to leverage to cash people. But it's something that is going to have to be done, and I'm going to sound like one of my colleagues in information technology, at a retail level rather than a wholesale level. In other words, you're going to have to look at people one by one to find out what's going on. It's quite a difficult task for SARS, and clearly it's something we will do, but we'd like to limit the number of people that are involved. The other thing to bear in mind is that the CRS is not a silver bullet. If I want a clean slate, there is a way to do it if I'm wealthy enough. Immigrate. Okay? Because the reports will now go to my new tax authority where I'm now based. I declare everything to them and I start from scratch. I've got my clean slate. Right? So it makes sense for us to also offer a clean slate. The question then, which is very validly raised here, what about the moral hazards? What is the right level of the price we should charge for the clean slate? And those are interlinked questions. So if you have a look at the 2003 amnesty, which is where a bunch of the people who are going to be knocking on our doors now should have been in the first place, there you got your clean slate at a price on the tax side, and we're going to speak to exchange control, of 2%. What we're looking for here now is substantially more than that. So if you're the kind of person who's going to wait for the next amnesty bus or the next voluntary disclosure bus, the message we're sending very clearly is the bus is getting more expensive every time you take it. Okay, so don't do that. Do things quicker, come forward earlier. So that then takes us to the question, how does it work? So let me work through three examples quickly using the 10 Rand. Should probably be 10,000 Rand or 10 million to make it more useful. Well, it has an extra zero at this point. So let's assume you don't come forward, and let's, just for the sake of argument, say this was money that was accumulated in the early 90s for whatever reason. Okay, perhaps you were in exile at that point, perhaps you were worried about where South Africa was going and took the money offshore for that reason. So if you don't come forward, what happens? Well, we say it should have been taxed in 1990, and so the law says we have to go back to 1990, tax you on that in 1990. Then we have to charge you interest on it from 1990. Anyone who has done the sums means that that interest bill is going to be huge. And obviously we have to tax every bit of income that's been derived on the 10 rand since 1990. So what does that all come down to? Well, ballpark figure means we're probably going to be charging you around 80%, so we want 8 rand of your 10 rand. Okay. But that's before exchange control. See, that's before exchange control comes into it, because if exchange control thinks that that money was taken off in breach of the ExCom regulations, they would have confiscated the 10 Rand too. So now we're going to go on to 18 Rand.
So the 10 Rand has to
play mediator between the two.
All right. The chair has made the point. If you're in that situation, you're going to look at this and think, well, okay, right, fine, that's pretty scary. So maybe I can take advantage of the voluntary disclosure program. So there the situation is, okay, now we're not going to hit you with understatement penalty. And by the way, my income is probably under because of the understatement penalty.
Yeah.
So that's probably going to be close to 9 or 10 rand in fact. So we're going to be charged 200 out of the 20 out of the 10. On the BDP side, we're going to say, okay, now understatement penalty. And we're still going to charge you interest, and we're still going to expect you to clear. So on that basis, well, maybe it's 6-7 rand that we're going to be charging you. It's still going to be expensive. And by the way, we've actually done the modeling for some of this to sort of see what the price points are, because when you talk to these people, obviously they're thinking, what is this going to cost me at the end of the day? So then we get to the special BDP. And there what we're going to say is, okay, so you got the 10 rand, but only include half of that, so 5 rand, and we'll charge you tax, so 40% of the 5, assuming you're in the top marginal bracket. So that comes out at around 2 rand that we want to charge you. Plus we're not going to charge you interest up until 2010. We'll charge you interest from that point onwards. There's no understatement penalty. So that means the bill will probably come out, then you may have an exchange control issue, 5 or 10% there. The total bill there will probably come out at around between 30 and 35%. Okay. Internationally, that's a little bit on the high side for this kind of program, but given our history, I think, and the fact that you've had opportunities to come forward before, that seems like a reasonable result. We're not trying to take all your money. We're not going to try and take more than all of your money, but at least we want you to make a significant contribution for that which you did not do before. And then obviously, going into the future, you're fully taxed on whatever comes out of that because we're on a residence basis of taxation.
Is it correct to understand you say about 35% of what you have?
It depends on how old the amount is, when you took it out and so forth. So it could be in a range of 20 to 35%. But that's what we're looking at.
Given that these people are high income tax earners, bank earners, if they would have left their money in the country, can you give that crude? I think it's very crude. This is a certain clarity, very crude. What would be the percentage they would have foregone to the state?
Then you would have been looking at around 40%.
I don't understand. You mean if you are a BDP applicant, you're going to lose 35% of what you lose.
If you stayed
in the country, then you lose 40%. So why don't you just put all your money in hopefully BDPs if you're rich?
That's why we have very strict cut off dates on this, so that you don't suddenly start pushing money off.
But look, maybe still I speak to Makosi or somebody else.
I think they still would like to make a comment.
Okay, let's just come in. I think this issue is one of clarity, so I'm going to allow all the interventions. Because this is quite important, unless the committee understands what you're saying. Basically, can I repeat what I think you're saying, Frank? You're saying that if I had 10 runs in the Cayman Islands, and using the BDP, I'm going to give you 3 runs, I'll take home 6 money. But if I didn't go to the Cayman Islands, then I would have been giving you 4 runs, right? And I get 6 runs. So why did I do this? Why did I put all my money there and then wait for your VEP special one and then just come in? And then I'm misunderstanding you. Let's start with that. Is that a quick understanding? That's what I think the committee understands. Let's explain, and then everybody comes in. Let's just deal with the specific issue of how does this VDP work precisely, what will be the material consequences for people, and so we can think to ourselves what is a morally and politically, we're not liberal moralists here, not the church or the mosque or whatever. It's actually balancing between moral, legal, and political, and economic, and financial issues. That's how we have to deal with it, I agree. But explain what happens to my 10 rand. Am I to say, I pay back 3 rand 50 if it's in the Kenan, I pay you back 4 rand if it's here in the FNB or whatever.
I think what Franz is saying that if they find you out, and you haven't pledged in the Cayman Islands, you're not going to pay for it,
we're going to pay 8 cents on mine.
No, fine, but if you declare, you can get away.
Yes.
The more you left, the person who was legal and moral and sound and paid all these other taxes and get the money and
so on, that's a question. By definition, it's not going to be fair in the sense that this person has taken the money out. Okay?
Yeah.
We don't know about it, okay? Because they may have taken out, there won't be an exile, I assure you. There would be, it would be someone from South Africa who probably seen a democratic government come in at some point, had taken the money out. They might have taken it out in 1990, 1992. They could also have taken it out after democracy, right? This is money we don't know about. So, at the moment, we will get zero. Okay. So now, how do you get a person there to come forward and tell us, and this money is hidden, okay, to come forward and tell us, previously in the world, you know, countries that have very high ethical standards, supposedly, you know, they would have secret bank accounts. Right? They would have organizations like FIFA doing all the nonsense, okay? You just can't get this information. Now, what had happened in the world was 2008, so that's why previous amnesties and so on were obviously limited, very limited in terms of what the amounts that came in. Because really, to be honest, some of the countries that the most powerful countries themselves are themselves tax havens. Okay, if you look at their tax rates, look at countries like the UK itself. You can look at Netherlands. You can look at Cleveland. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And all the islands that fall under British rule. In fact, that's been the criticism. Okay. So you just couldn't get that info. What is the game changer now? The game changer is, come 2008, the crisis, suddenly the very countries that would actually allow this practice, would refuse to give us the info, are themselves affected. And so the US starts with FATCA, and wants us to report on American citizens. What countries like South Africa and a few others said, no, this can't be a one-way thing, it should be two ways. You must give us info as well. Okay? And this thing had built up in the OECD, and I must say thanks to the fiscal policy people who were always focused on this but were never heard, sort of managed to make this an international agreement. Okay. So for the first time, people who have money now know there's no such thing as secret bank accounts anymore. Okay. But you still can't just get this information. You can't go on a fishing expedition. So one, you've got this. So we said, okay, now the world's changing. By the time we get to know, we still won't get everybody. Part of it is, even both we and the person who's hiding don't know whether they'll be caught in this round or not, okay? Depends what documents they gave, etc. So what happens is, we thought, let's push people now to come forward, okay? And let me say, many people may even run away overseas, so you'll never get them with this coming. We don't want people to run away, we want them to pay the due, and like France says, not just get some amount that we can demand, but one day in the system, it's going to be a continual source of income. So I'm saying, let's get a competitor right, we're comparing against what they would have paid, the world's changing. And that's why things like Panama and before that HSBC and so on are really good things for developing countries because they're showing us names. And that we need to act. And Jay does get into the issues that we've touched on in separate hearings on illicit flows. You know, as you said, there's transfer pricing, there's this, there's that. This is another element of it. It's what private people hold overseas and how do we get them? But maybe I don't know if France, if I use the right comparison, you may disagree with me.
Sure, a fair point to be made, which is what is your career comparison versus the way it's faced by the rules? A person who has successfully gotten out of the system and potentially to keep out of the system. So, and that's a judgment call. So,
we've pitched it at a particular level. People may disagree. If you look at the international benchmarks, there is no one right answer, but I will say they tend to be a bit cheaper than we are. Again, the reason I say that makes sense in our context is we've given people the opportunity previously to come clean, and if they're still in the position, well, my first question is why didn't they use one of those previous opportunities? So, in any event,
one of the biggest issues currently, Chair, that you have is that the U.S. has a weird system of taxation. You know, all the big companies are outside the U.S. They get taxed in the country where they are operating. Now, okay, they've finagled the system by making sure it's in a low-tax jurisdiction that gets to the transfer pricing issues. But when they repatriate the cash back to the U.S., they pay quite a huge tax of, you know, 38%, okay. So what's happened is massive amount of funds are not going back to the U.S. The corporates all expect that there will be an amnesty so that they bring the money back. At the moment, many companies are what they're doing inversions, okay, where they get a company to buy them and then they move the domicile to the country. The latest that you had was Pfizer and what was the other company? And pharmaceutical companies have been doing this. The Obama administration about 2 weeks ago sort of basically put some regs and stopped that whole deal effectively. So I'm saying these things are big issues that are happening, and it's quite an issue of, as I said, cat and mouse. How do you get this money into the country? Okay. It's not like we know where everything is, and therefore the alternative is that we can get it and have a high amount. At the moment, we're sitting on zero. But it's a political judgment call, Chair. Will we accept that?
I'd just like to, there were a couple of other questions around the GDP, so I can just quickly tick them off. So there's the question of whether you find yourself in the situation deliberately or by way of ignorance. I would say, just speaking from my gut feel and previous experience, that most people in the situation find themselves here deliberately, but that doesn't rule out the possibility that you're here because of negligence. And that is one of the reasons why we have a no-name approach. So you can come forward to us and say, like, this is my situation, I need to apply. Does it make sense? And we can say, no, that's fine. I mean, you're perfectly legitimate, or we can say, no.
You
can
send
the lawyer. You send the lawyer, because that way we don't take your registration plate. No. Sorry, that's a joke. Great. Once you apply, but at least you know whether you need to not. So why do you need that process? Because once we know about you, it's not a voluntary disclosure anymore. So you have the ability to come forward with no name. There was a question of if you're under investigation by one and not the other. Well, we do tend to coordinate, but that is a possibility. And if there's a problem on the exchange control, but not on the ZARS or vice versa, you can apply for the one that you don't have a problem with. But as I say, we do try and coordinate. Let me just have a quick look. What other issues were there? Oh, set clause. What are set clause? Okay, so in a trust, the person who sets up the trust and puts the initial assets into it is known as settlor. In other jurisdictions, maybe known as the founder. So what we've said here, and this is precisely to preserve this concept of an ongoing cash flow from the tax, we said trust can't apply for this. What you need to do is put the asset back into the hands of an individual for tax purposes. It doesn't have to be done actually. But it comes back into the hands of a person in our taxing jurisdiction that we can then tax. And that is precisely to preserve the ongoing. So that's what a set clause is. I think there may be an exchange control comment as well on the SDDP, but I think that wraps it up.
I think, Tandy, on
Sandy's
asked earlier about the 12%.
I'm moving from the VDP.
Spoke about the 12% increase, say that we add an additional 2% because you're coming from South Africa. You must put yourself in the position of a person who's got a holiday in another country. Now, why should he sell and pay the levy and then get a 2% less levy, or I don't pay,
paying 10% and then having to buy a new house. So he would prefer to use his South African liquid assets and pay the extra 2% or the total 12%. And outside of the VVD country, it's 20 to 40%, so it's still a market for him. By 12 compared to 20 or 40, 40% of the size. Then there was a question of Mr.
So there's a lot of questions for you.
The last point I want to make, I think, was Mr. Brandon, who said he's got a bank account. I mean, how does he know it's illegal? It would depend on the source of the funding. If you traveled abroad using a travel allowance, then maybe you left the funds in a bank account as irregular and you have to come clean. But I think France also said to you, you can approach us anonymously, and then we'll give you a ruling on the matter. Thank you.
Not the BDP, sir. Okay, so then you have in order of Mahosi, Kwanka, and Tali. Anybody else? No. Okay.
Just a small one on BDP. I just wanted the National Treasury to just outline the only process for an investigation process on those that may have foreign assets or taxes. And the reason why I'm saying that is because you've said here that persons who are under, who have a pending audit or investigation may not apply, and that has an implication. So if you actually advise people when that happens, I think that's also very important. Because what if I come and I want to make a disclosure, then say, aha, we got you. You are already under investigation. I think that's also important.
Actually, I just want to make this point before I get to the VCT. Sorry. No, I wasn't saying that must be intrusive or government must be intrusive. The point I was making was that, you know, we have a lot of policies that we develop as government. And I intended to protect the poor, but the poor are anti-welfare. That's the problem. So I was saying, if we've had to exempt a certain items, why aren't we communicating clearly to the public so that they can make an informed decision? That also applies to the excise duties, for example, transfer prices on properties. If you look at that property, 750, that protects the Western home buyers, for instance. But our people are with that, that is an emphatic no. Except for a few who have privilege not to have that information. The second issue I want to ask about this VDP, Chair, is in some instances, say for example, rather negligence, I want to weigh in on that point and say in some instances they might find themselves in that position because of bad advice that they might have gotten, for example, from a financial planner or a banker. Say there was a scheme at the time which was working well and it gave the people bad advice. The same goes, I think, a lot of clients have been receiving a lot of bad advice when it comes to the usage of trust and how to pay tax and so on and so forth. How do you deal with such a situation?
Rather naughtily, non-VDP question. So don't answer that for now. VDP questions, Tani?
Before I go to my follow-up question, I want to say that first is on time. See, if you want to get somebody to disclose, you entice them, and you cannot entice them by being expensive. It's not entitlement. So I don't see anything wrong with the 35% as a sense of the assumption that you come to that. But we'll come to doing further discussing it. Let me ask this. The issue of the 2%, why I was asking it, there's an assumption that the liquidity of an individual within the proximity of South Africa will be above the investment they got offshore. It's a wrong assumption. It's not given. It's not given that your assets that you hold in the country might be above the immovable assets or any other assets that you hold that you've invested offshore. So if you think that imposing a 12% penalty on the person if they don't have liquid funds to pay off, it's going to automatically translate to them giving you what they have in the country. It's that assumption. You might find that the properties and the assets that an individual holds in South Africa might be even reduced to just property as in a house and few assets that will not even match what they've put offshore, based on the fact that offshore they pay less tax for that. Therefore, if you do mathematics, you want to put more where you're not going to pay more tax than you put more, you're going to pay more tax. If they're going to pay 40% here, why would they put here? They would have little assets here and more assets offshore. So the reason why I was saying, let's relook the principle of the imposure of the penalty was for those who are prepared to do special disclosure, but who are not in their hands having a liquid asset, but might have an immovable asset. In that context, those might be the ones that generate even more income for us if we do that analysis. So I still don't get it very clear that assumption gives us the figures that we might. Because I take it for granted you also make a projection of how much you collect in any end that you start to get those claims that have been put forward and those that are not even there. If you get the point I'm trying to get.
This is a comment from what he was saying. There is a reason for this VEP program again. Many people didn't trust the first amnesty. And then also there's a case of...
Why didn't they trust
it? Because exactly that's, you know, they thought that, you know, you'd say, oh, you knew about it before, you can't get this amnesty. So, all right? No, I was a counselor at the time. Then you get other cases. Children have inherited this proceeds of illegal offshore money evasion. And remember, since the 1960s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, taking money out of South Africa was the in thing to do. It was more, you know, avoiding the apartheid exchange control regulations. I mean, people did it. And they either need to bring this money back. Our country needs the exchange control, we need the taxation, and we must provide people the opportunity to come clean.
You've got less than 12:36, you've got less than 24 minutes, right? I don't mean to take any more questions. You want to quickly ask the last batch of questions, please? Right, we're rounding up here, 24 minutes. I'm gone, but the meeting carries on for a while. Yes, but Mr. Kwaka, I'm going to bring your other questions and you'll respond to them, I'll respond to them later down the road.
Sure, I hear what you said, Eric.
No, I'll smug you a question. No,
now you can ask anything. I don't have a question. Actually, it's to explain that one. It is, one of my colleagues agrees with me here. That's an example, clients or bankers that deal with the high income clients do give this kind of advice to us. Right? Now, you might have a situation where, say, in future, some of the clients that you're going to catch up come to you and say, but I was given advice by my banker. Right? And there's a need analysis is contained.
Yes.
That's
an easy question.
That's what I'm saying, right? Yeah. That's the point I was making. I was saying it's a VD question. It actually links up with the negligence issue. Now, we might have this need analysis as a bank to comply with the FISA or legislation, but no one actually reads that. That's the honesty. Even the client himself or herself never usually gets that advice. They don't reach that. That's what is contained in the needs analysis, right? So if you come around and you say you actually recognize 2 or 3 years down the line that we're giving bad advice, why are you going to deal with those clients? Because I'm sure you're going to get a lot of those. Even those who didn't get the wrong advice might actually end up shifting the blame to the bankers.
Very quickly then, audit process. So the way it's asked is the audit process is you're led to engage. That way you know you're under audit and you're excluded. Investigation, you normally, well, it depends on the nature of the investigation. So investigations would be, they're sort of sounding like you're thinking criminal there. So we have two kinds of audit. We have what we call compliance or investigative audit. Really that speaks to the complexity and the amount of work that needs to be done. Investigative audits would typically be the ones that stop with a letter to you saying this is the terms of the engagement. The accountants will sort of remember this kind of terminology from audits. We've sort of adopted it, so we let you know what you're coming for and what we'd like to see. If we start talking criminal, the two ways you end up in criminal, the one is there was an audit and we identified that there was something that was of a criminal nature that needs to be pursued. That fits the audit then into what we would call the civil side, which is where we're just looking at the tax and the criminal side. Then the criminal part of the investigation, it runs separately and has got to be done in terms of the constitutional sort of precepts of someone who's potentially accused. The bad advice point, that's precisely why you have an ongoing voluntary disclosure program. So it allows you to come forward and say, this is something I got wrong, this is something where I was advised badly, this is something even potentially where I did something deliberately wrong, but let you come forward before we get to you and clean it up. If you're interested, if you can have a look at section 223 of the Tax Administration Act,
And what that is a table that says how we will penalize someone. And essentially what it does is worse the behavior, the higher the penalty. And there are two columns that deal with voluntary disclosure. And so voluntary disclosure that you make before we start an audit is treated the most generously because you have come to us. If there's a voluntary disclosure that is a result of an audit, so you sort of say, well, you've sort of caught me, but you haven't noticed this, that is not treated as generously because if you think about it, if it wasn't fully voluntary, we were putting pressure on you to make the disclosure. The question of the 2%, I think at its heart, the idea of the 2%, and I'm speaking on behalf of Reserve Bank now, so they can always correct me, is really to try and encourage people to use offshore funds to settle the levy rather than use their onshore funds. So I think if you come down to the nut and bolts, that's all it's trying to achieve. And then there's the question of why didn't people come forward with trust? I mean, we really worked very hard in the 2003 amnesty to give people all the good reasons to trust us, but I think there may well have been some that didn't, and hopefully we've demonstrated our bona fides with the voluntary disclosure program that's been in place since 2010 and then later on since 2012.
Yeah, I was going to add, obviously, given that the legislation is before Parliament and you will be taking comments, you know, we are hoping to still get comments, so even on the issue of whether it should be 6 months or not, I don't think we agree with that, and certainly, but we're not stuck on that. I mean, we're open to hearing, so let's see what people say and how they motivate. But the chances are that the people who fall in this category know who they are and will apply quickly. And frankly, the longer they don't apply, they get caught through other means. You know, they will then not qualify. So I think, and this is different from other amnesties in the sense that the story is different here in the sense that there's pressure now coming from places where they thought they would never ever be pressured. So the info is coming out, and like Cecil reminded me, for children who inherit, you know, there's a prime minister who's been caught in this mix, right, in the UK. So this stuff is all coming out, and I think that these are actually broader questions, Chair, because it gets back to the wealth issues and how the rich have not paid their due and so on and so on. So it's not a South African issue. And so Chair, we will be still taking comments, and so when people ask us, we say, please come to Parliament, you know, submit your comment, why you think it needs to be longer, and we will like everything, obviously.
Yeah, there's a few questions, and I'll try and answer some of these specific questions. Just on the timing, we have had a discussion about the possibility of bringing forward the 1st October date to provide some flexibility between staff and the Reserve Bank. But that, obviously, during the comment process, we can see how achievable that is. Just on the question of the Honourable Minister talking about the bottom group of people between 70... this group of people between north and 188,000 is there. If you go to this table, this gives you an indication. It's not the exact number. So this is between north and 70 and 70 and 150. Now let's take the 750. There is about 2.5, 2.6 million people. Now given the nature of the South African economy, it's very hard to pinpoint the actual compare this with the income distribution. What we can say to you, some do have data on the gender, so we can break down the different gender. The data on race is not in the tax system, so because the tax form doesn't pass the race, so that would be impossible to do. You can impute that data on income and expenditure data that they provide. There they do have presentation, just to answer the question. On the question on tax rate that Honorable Talese asked, yes, the corporate tax rate has come down internationally. If you go back, our corporate tax rate was as high as 45% in the early 90s, I think. It's now sitting at 28%. And our corporate tax rate is high on the high side. A lot of other countries have a much lower corporate tax. So the overall trend internationally is to come up with a relatively lower corporate tax rate and a relatively high PIT rate. And as Norma indicated, is that the point that from an economic point of view, a lot of the corporate taxes are passed on to individuals in any case. The corporate tax system is basically a withholding form of tax. It's still an important form of tax. And what we now do in the reforms is to, instead of stopping the rate, we try to broaden the base and protect the base. So that's the corporate tax rate. On elasticity, we have quite a lot of information that we do. This is a slide we prepare in-house for our revenue estimation process. If you look at this slide, it shows you how tax revenue responds to the growth in GDP. And we have this by tax type also. We have quite a bit of information that goes back quite a while, and you can see in some years the tax were higher than one, which means it responds much higher, and in other cases it's lower. And it's very much in the business cycle. So that's the question.
Process, Professor. Because you can just say, I have to leave, right? I have a matter I have to attend to. Very quickly, though. An important matter I have to mention. Tomorrow we have the FICA bill, right? We spent far more than we planned to, I think, of a number of hours. You had endless meetings also at a ministry department with stakeholders. And from what I can tell, there's a substantial agreement now. So what you have this morning, because Parliament, I mean, my PA had no secret. None of the committees here have been concerned for the last 3 months. So let me tell you the real world I come from. Okay, first thing more.
Now
on this issue, what we have suggested to the executive, and Frank, am I right, you've been through this, we ask them to bring the B version of the bill. Okay, the B version of the bill, which is what we agreed previously with Volta, previously informal. Then what we will do is formally we have to separate it out, right? And vote on the A version of the bill. We've been through this before. The usefulness of this is that what you will see is firstly, everything that underlined Frank is the National Treasury's proposals on amendments to the Original Act. Okay? Then, what you have in yellow is what a committee proposed and further amendments. So the sections in yellow are those that we proposed as a committee. The sections that are underlined are the original amendments brought to the Act by National Treasury. So when we tomorrow meet, what I suggested to them is, firstly, because of the huge gaps between sittings, you must give us an overview of the policy issues, okay? And just tell us how they resolve the contested policy issues. But this is not going to open the thing up again. It's just to remind us and fine tune it. But not going to start from square one again. Then they must actually tell us how we'll go through the section that they've amended, and then we will process the vote. We'll not vote on it tomorrow. We'll vote on it next Tuesday. Now, there are two issues we'll vote on next Tuesday. One, let's vote. Whatever happens, we're going to vote on Tuesday, even to sit right through. Two is the report on the budget vote of the National Treasury. Now what is worrying me, Alan and others, we don't have work, is that next week we have only one sitting day in Parliament. The likelihood of members turning up just for a Tuesday from the far corner of the country, you know, I don't know what is going to happen. And if we don't turn up, I'll be here, but I'm just saying I'm worried about it in forums. Our funds could have functioned on when they meet next week. But that's something we need to leave to the works to deal with. For now, please, can you try to go through the bill before you come tomorrow? It's not fair on the ministry and department to go through the whole thing again. And as I say, I'm going to be very rich. If you're bringing in something new, yes. If you're fine-tuning what we read, yes. But we're not asking, unless you bring, you know, not asking you to cover the same ground we covered for hours and hours. Yes, Sandy?
We have the report. Copies. Our secretary can give us copies, please. No, that's the reason I'm saying don't leave without, because we will email it to you, kind of, in color. And when we print it, we can't, there's no printing capacity in color anymore. We are too poor now. Okay, so now, of course, you are free to finish the short. Just on the FICA bill, I will submit our proposed amendments this afternoon at approximately 3:30.
Yes,
you
can do that, but
we've been sitting in committees. You chose not to come. It makes no impact on us. It's your right to not come. Maybe you have some effect when you abstain from the House, but you can have no impact on the committee. No one even notices. So no, you can table it, but you can't decide not to come to committee meetings and we must appear and entertain them now. No, we go through the legal, the rule process. Okay? We're in the final stages. We've sat for hours and hours on this one. So I will go by the rules. I will consult Frank Jenkins, that's it. Thank you very much.
You can consider our amendments or not. I'll put in the National Assembly back.
Oh, that's fine. That's your right. Operate by the rules.
You got the program, right? We wouldn't absent ourselves from the committee.
There's no program that was changed for any conspiracy reasons. Let's not have that again. Because I kept lying, I'm lying when I told you how it happened. That's what you basically say.
And you were curious. And the committee welcomes you.
Yeah, we're going to do consult with the rules. But nobody misled you. Nobody lied. Nobody's corrupt here. Nobody's corrupt. I told you what happened. Let's not cover that down again. But there's no such thing, Frank, that we can choose to abstain on the most absurd reason from committee meetings and then expect us to start the whole process again. That they can table it as a formality, that is their right. And our right is, so we'll observe your right. That's all.
Okay, Chair, with our powers vested, we need a meeting with finish at 1 o'clock. Treasury, answer the question. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. There's just one or two that I'll pick up and then I'll round up. There was a question on CDT. I think one must compare the situation we find ourselves in terms of, you saw in the earlier slide the significant revenue decline that you experienced this past year. And the question was, where do we look for revenue coming from the next year? And we really balanced the needs for the fiscus for revenue and the importance of economic growth. And the point that you raised here was very pertinent. At the time, we find there has been there is some scope within the CGP framework to raise some additional revenue. Now, where do we end on this? In many countries, the inclusion rate for companies is 100%, and for individuals, it's 50%. Now, don't say we can end there, but we still, compared to many other countries that do have CGP, on the low side in terms of effective inclusion rate. On the primary residence, I just want to indicate to you that if you buy a house and you live in a house, it's completely exempt from CGP. So up to 2 million. So primary residents are excluded from CGP, and therefore we've got that protection. On the medical tax credit, personally, I think there we try our best to provide a reasonable, fair relief. If medical expenditure is increasing over time, you'll have to look at the bigger reform around NHI to contextualize this debate, and it's a big debate. We have provided input into that. We think there's still a lot of importance to retain the medical tax credit until such time that the debate around the NHI is explored. But for now, we are confident to continue to adjust it at least for inflation. Obviously, it's not for medical inflation at this stage. There might be an argument that we should look at medical inflation, but I think that's a different question. I think that, Chair, is more or less what I want to say. On the tire levy, be assured that this is not an additional tax. There's already a tire fee in place. We're just basically replacing the existing fee with a more explicit tax that some would collect. We have worked with the Department of Environmental Affairs and with our budget office. We have lots of discussion. A lot of this money will, that's not ring fence, will go back to the industry to support recycling efforts. So there will be on budget allocation for that particular purpose. And that's the commitment we have made with the Department of Environmental Affairs and our budget office. Although that's not our responsibility. I think, Chair, that's the major contract. Let me just talk about that. I mean, this is a really a very important question. I'd like the committee at one stage to actually debate the issue on that. That is a very important revenue source for the government. And if you look at this chart, you'll see we have collected around 26% of revenue from VAT over time on average.
Many people out there bend as the regressive tax, and therefore you must be very poorly taken. It's important that you look at the tax as a whole, and how the tax system as a whole are progressive or regressive, and not look at one particular instrument. So if you look at this slide here, you see how that rate is on the low side. Obviously, this is not a full comparison, but even with emerging economies, our VAT rate is on the low side. So there is a scope to increase the VAT rate. But that's a very touchy political issue to look at, and I think we should not suppress that debate, but see what options going forward. On zero rating and exemptions, and I agree with you, we should probably revisit that basket. A lot of people say you should completely do away with all zero rating and exemption, and rather support people through a grant system. And I think that is the level of play, because the problem with the zero rating and the list, what is a necessary item for some people is a luxury for other people. And it's very hard to become very subjective. We think it's very risky to deal with that, because you will end up with instead of a shorter list, you can end up with a longer list, and then undermine the VAT system. I think that's more or less what I want to talk about, unless there's something that I urgently must share.
I was just going to say, I don't know if there are any other questions. There were lots of questions. In fact, if there were specific ones we haven't answered, if you just give us a list, we can give written responses so members actually have. We'll also maybe just do a check. Obviously, we're not able to deal with all the questions in detail, and we have focused on the tax issues, not on the border issues.
No, thank you. I think we will stop there now. I know most of my questions are not answered, and obviously they are part of a bigger discussion. But the idea really was to sensitize the members that it's actually very important for us to approach these issues in an integrated way, because if people are just going to be considering fiscal policy review only, excluding the other factors that are impacting on it, we may actually end up with serious problems later on. So, member, thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much.
The speaking chair now, Benjamin Makosi Kuma. Thank you.